Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I heard people talk about anger on the Saturday program, and then I was just thinking about that incident. And what I've been doing since that day is listening to specific music like Fela Kuti or Bob Marley. I might listen to old programs of Dr. Weldon, Neely Fuller, The Cows. And also, I've been listening to motivational speakers. I think one is called one of the guys is Eric Thomas, a black guy, and another guy, a black guy, is Les Brown. And that's been helping me out a lot. Like they still make like jungle noises and do weird things, but everything that I've been doing, and then along with working out, thanks to Emmy, I started working out again.
All right. If you haven't been an avid exerciser, never fear. It's not too late necessarily. A recent study shows that if you take up routine exercises, even in late middle age, you can actually reverse some of the damage that a sedentary lifestyle does to your heart. Here's NPR's Patty Naiman.
By your mid-40s, your heart may start to show signs of aging, especially if you don't exercise regularly. Cardiologist Ben Levine.
The heart gets smaller and stiffer.
And eventually, it doesn't pump blood as efficiently as it used to, making some activities difficult.
The pressure inside the heart goes up really high, and the blood will back up into the lungs, making people very, very short of breath.
Levine studies exercise and fitness at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. He wanted to know if starting routine exercise in midlife or even later could prevent this decline in the heart. He recruited patients between 45 and 64 who were otherwise healthy but did not exercise. May Ansri was 62 at the time.
I have my hobbies. I do ballroom dancing, and in my leisure time that I like, and I do gardening.
Enjoyable, but not a daily routine.
No discipline.
Ansri was one of 53 volunteers in Levine's study who were divided into two groups. One did weightlifting and yoga 3 days a week. Ansri was in the other group, which did moderate to high-intensity exercise most days of the week. After 2 years, the group doing the more frequent, higher-intensity exercise saw dramatic improvements in heart health.
We took these 50-year-old hearts and turned the clock back to 30 or 35-year-old hearts.
Their hearts processed oxygen more efficiently and were notably less stiff.
And the reason that they got so much stronger and fitter was because their hearts now could fill much better and pump a lot more blood during exercise.
The hearts of those doing less regular exercise didn't change. For May Ansri, the study was life-changing. Today, she exercises every day of the week, walking and jogging at least 5 miles. If she misses a day, she says she just doesn't feel good, and it's helped her mental health, too.
I'm not moody. I mean, I'm happy.
A key part of the exercise regimen was interval training, short bursts of high-intensity exercise followed by a few minutes of rest. For example, Levine says this 4x4 interval training.
It's an old Norwegian ski team workout. It means 4 minutes at 95% of your maximal ability, followed by 3 minutes of active recovery, repeated 4 times.
Pushing as hard as you can for 4 minutes stresses the heart and forces it to function more efficiently. Levine says if you haven't done high-intensity exercise and decide to start, make sure you build up gradually. Cardiologist Nisa Goldberg, spokesperson for the American Heart Association, says Levine's findings are important.
Many studies that are done that look at cardiovascular health look at improvements in risk factors for heart attack and stroke, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes. But this study specifically looked at heart function and how heart function can improve with exercise.
Goldberg says the findings are a great start, but the study was small and it needs to be repeated with far larger groups of people. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
And his plastic excuse. Oh, I hate the white man.
In the same issue of National Geographic, there's a piece by Michelle Norris. She's the former host of this show, who now runs the Race Card Project, in which she asked people to send in their thoughts on race in just 6 words. When she began the project in 2010, Norris assumed she'd hear mostly from people of color. She was wrong.
I think what happened is people felt that they had an entry into a conversation that wasn't always welcome to them. And it was a place where they could say things that you don't generally say out loud. And so people of all races pulled up to the table, but white Americans in very large numbers bought into the project and decided to share their stories. And here are some examples. White, not allowed to be proud. Gay, but at least I'm white. Hated for being a white cop. Abuse was invisible because I'm white. Other races resent us white people. Most white people are not racist. White people do not own racism. I unpack my white privilege daily.
Norris digs into some of these feelings in her story, The Rising Anxiety of White America. It focuses on the town of Hazleton, Pennsylvania. Since the year 2000, it's gone from being more than 95% white to more than half Latino. That change makes some of the white residents uncomfortable.
When people talked about it, it was often the notion of suddenly being outnumbered. That's a word that I heard over and over and over again. Going to the doctor's office and suddenly looking around and realizing everybody else is Hispanic. Going to the local Walmart and realizing, boy, the things that they're selling in the produce aisle are different. Or there's a whole aisle where everything is written in two different languages, and I never noticed that before. Or the people who are checking me out when I go to buy lumber or groceries, they're different. And suddenly people are speaking Spanish, and suddenly it feels like this community that I knew so well, is what they were saying, is that they don't feel like it's theirs anymore. And that coupled with economic changes, with jobs disappearing, and that coupled with the cultural things in a town where you had a very strong immigrant population for decades. You know, there were people from Italy and people from Ireland and people from Germany, and they all had their traditions. And suddenly they have to make space for newcomers who come in. But when the newcomers are brown and when the newcomers are less interested in assimilating in the same way and suddenly speaking English, they want to hold on to their old culture and they want to hold on to their old language. Suddenly the word immigrant doesn't have the same ring to it.
Michelle Norris, as you've had these conversations with white people about the discomfort they feel, about the change they see around them, how much did they seem to, in their own minds, connect that discomfort to issues of race?
It was interesting because they wouldn't necessarily say those brown people. There would often be sort of proxy for that. You know, the food is different, the music is different, the town feels different. There was a large threat narrative. I mean, people felt like with the changing community that the crime rate had increased or that they just didn't feel as safe as they used to. In some cases, it was for a good reason. Someone had literally drove a car into their restaurant or someone had a wallet taken. In a lot of cases, though, the fear was based on something in the abstract, not something that had actually happened to them. And there was a difference in the way that people who were more advanced in years talked about it than the kids.
Mm-hmm. I do want to ask about the next generation because you do talk about that a bit. And I feel like in general, a lot of these discussions about race seem to sometimes almost end with platitudes that the next generation will be more enlightened, more colorblind, or at least more comfortable with difference. Do you share that hope, or is that in some way a naive hope?
Well, I am optimistic by nature. and yet I'm pragmatic. And so I know that when we say that race is perhaps an easier concept for young people, it's easier, but it's not easy. In fact, there's a body of social research that suggests that young people, despite inheriting this world that is so much more diverse, still sometimes cling to values that their parents had or that their parents' parents had. And yet, I think the future is still something that we should be optimistic about, but it might take 2, 3, 4 generations before some of this gets easier. And it's not just because of demographics and race. It's also because of the economic tumult that we're facing. And it's also because of technological tumult. I mean, people's jobs are being replaced in large part by technology, and that creates a certain degree of vertigo. So it's not one thing. There are a lot of onions in that stew.
Michel Norris is the author of The Rising Anxiety of White America in the April issue of National Geographic and a former NPR host. Thank you so much for joining us.
It is great to be back here. Thanks so much.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Seattleite Merlin Rainwater advocates for alternative forms of transportation like walking and biking. She leads neighborhood slow rides to get older women more comfortable biking in the city. Recently, she added a new kind of ride, a tour of the so-called Red Line that segregated Seattle for decades. KUOW's Ann Dornfeld reports.
Merlin Rainwater has lived in the Central District for 3 decades. So when she started her bike tours, she showed people around her neighborhood. Public art, little-known parks. Then one day, she saw a display at her neighborhood library, Douglas Truth. It had pictures and documents from the struggle for open housing in Seattle in the 1950s and 60s.
And as I looked at it, I thought, you know, this is information that really ought to be in Laurelhurst, because Black people in the Central District, they know this history. It's the white folks in the segregated white parts of the city that need to know that there was a struggle for open housing in Seattle.
Even after the city passed an open housing ordinance in 1968, the city was still segregated for another decade by redlining. That's where banks discriminated against people who wanted to borrow for properties in certain neighborhoods, like the Central District. Rainwater wanted to bring this kind of history to the mostly white people who go on her bike tours.
I came across an article about the historic maps of redlining, the maps that were created by the Federal Housing Authority. I looked at the map of Seattle online and I thought, oh, you know, a map and a line, oh, that could be a bike ride.
So this whole block right across the street here had racially restrictive covenants on it.
But Rainwater was surprised by how many people wanted to learn what she wanted to teach. The first time she offered her bike the Red Line tour, so many people showed up that they had to split into 2 groups.
I've done it several times, and the main reaction has been, you need to do more of this.
So this is the Red Line map. This is the racial map of Seattle. And you'll notice that this area here that's red, which is the red lined area that we're going to be exploring, pretty much corresponds with this section of undesirable racial groups. Now,
Rainwater says the ride shows how the effects of redlining still linger in the Central District.
We see both the remnants of disinvestment and segregation side by side with the influx of wealth and gentrification. It's thought-provoking.
Rainwater hopes people come away from the tour with the understanding that racial segregation was no accident.
It was a result of a number of very deliberate policies on part of the white power structure that wanted to keep the majority of the city white.
Rainwater says it's important that white people, like her, do their part to educate other white people.
It really is white people's history. White people were the actors that developed and implemented the policies that led to segregation. And it's really inappropriate to, let's say, segregate those aspects of history that Black people suffered under and label those Black history as if they weren't relevant to the rest of us.
In the Central District, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
Why should the Black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years? Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one, first you have to realize that up until 1910, 1859, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And naturally, it was so negative until it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African.
National Geographic magazine brought the world to readers through meticulous reports and gorgeous photographs. Now it's released an issue on race. It begins with a look in the mirror at how the magazine has portrayed different races and ethnicities over more than a century. Karen Grigsby Bates from our Code Switch team reports.
The bright yellow border signals, yes, this is National Geographic. But this special issue isn't inviting readers to visit Peru or Ethiopia in its pages. This time, the coverage focuses specifically on race and the role the Geographic has played in its 130-year history in shaping Americans' views on race.
What we really want to do is to create a conversation about something that is so central to understanding the United States in the 21st century.
That's Editor-in-Chief Susan Goldberg, National Geographic's first woman editor. Goldberg oversaw what most people are calling the race issue. In a letter she wrote for the issue, Goldberg said she felt the magazine couldn't cover race and diversity without acknowledging its own problematic past.
And it felt very much to me that if we were going to write about the subject of race, that to do so credibly, we needed to look back at our own history.
John Edwin Mason is a historian at the University of Virginia. He's also African American, and he was tasked with diving into the archives of the Geographic to see how it relayed the world to its readers. He found a hierarchy.
And that hierarchy was very clear in the writing and in the photography, that the West, and especially the English-speaking world, was at the top of the hierarchy. And black and brown people were somewhere underneath.
And Mason is clear on why that is.
It was a magazine that was editorially controlled almost exclusively by white men.
For more than a century, women, Jewish, and black people were denied membership in the National Geographic Society. The race issue contains a scientific look at how and why skin color evolved over time. The rise in interracial and same-gender marriages, racial profiling, and white anxiety as the nation gets browner. You'll hear about that in a moment. All this, says Goldberg, is an effort to move forward, but this work is still done by a largely white staff. Historian John Edwin Mason says the Geographic has made progress in the past few decades, but it has a way to go.
You still won't find very many voices from the Global South writing in the pages of National Geographic. You still see too few photographers of color.
We're not there yet.
But Goldberg says they're working on it. Next month, the Geographic looks at Muslims in America. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
I've seen a lot of troubles lately.
Oh, well,
how be that? I don't know. Who I
am. For the 2020 census, the U.S. Census Bureau has changed some of the questions it asks. Among them, how black people are asked to designate their race. This means many people may have to take a closer look at their family trees to define their ethnic origin. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang has more.
On the upcoming census form, you'll likely see a new space under the checkbox for black or African American. That's where you're supposed to write in non-Hispanic origins, such as African American, Jamaican, Nigerian, or if you're Nyatamara, Ethiopian.
I'm African. I identify as black, but I don't see myself as an African American.
So Amara says with this change for the 2020 census, she can be more specific about her black identity.
We can't just be black as African Americans. We are black from Africa. We're black from the Caribbean. We're black from everywhere.
The Census Bureau has said it's been trying to respond to calls for, quote, more detailed, disaggregated data for our diverse American experiences. You can hear some of that diversity at African Services Committee. This is where Nia Tamara works as a legal advocate for immigrants in New York City. And there are so many languages of the African diaspora spoken here.
Soninke, Mandingo, Wolof, what else?
Meluso Bakala, the director of program operations, who is Ethiopian-American, needs help naming them.
Malinke, come tell me these other languages.
Pula, Amharic,
French, the common language in the office.
That was Amanda Lugg with the assist. She considers herself Black British, and she's the director of advocacy for people living with HIV at African Services Committee, which offers free health screenings to immigrants. Lugg says more detailed census data about Black people's ancestry could improve her organization's public health work.
This is a great step forward in terms of being able to get more specific information on who's actually living here, yeah.
But Meluso Pakala says here's the rub about the census asking for people's origins. Around the country, there's growing distrust in turning over personal information to the government.
Are people willing to answer that question, given the current anti-immigrant sentiment? That I can't tell you.
I mean, literally, this keeps me up at night. Because it's not just about filling out the census.
This is Christina Greer, a political science professor at Fordham University.
I'm the author of Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream.
Greer warns that if fewer Black people participate in the 2020 census, there could be an undercount. And that could have impacts lasting long after 2020 on redistributing seats in Congress and drawing up legislative districts. Still, Greer says she's planning to write down Black American for her origins.
I consider myself a JB, which is just Black. So when people ask you where you're from, and I say, oh, you know, New York, Philly, Chicago, Baltimore, it's like, no, but where are you from?
It's a question, Greer says, that's hard, if not impossible, to answer for many African Americans who have roots in the U.S. going back centuries to ancestors forced upon these shores as enslaved people.
If we're really honest with what hundreds of years of U.S. chattel slavery really meant, many people had to walk miles and across countries before they were shipped off.
And that cut ties to home countries for their descendants, including Chris Owens, a project engineer for an energy consulting firm based in New York City.
I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and either you're Black or you're white, at least where I'm from.
Owens says for most of his life, questions about his race were straightforward. But after moving to Boston and later New York...
I've been asked if I'm Haitian, Jamaican, any Caribbean, just based on how I look. That's even caused me to try to figure out which island I was from.
Owen says just over 2 years to keep digging into family history for an answer before the 2020 census forms come out. For now, though, if you ask him about his origins, he says he's sticking with American. Anzi Luong, NPR News, New York.
On the show today, the consequences of bias and racism. And those consequences can affect everything from the opportunities you have to where and how you get educated and even your health.
Black women in the United States are 4 times more likely to die during pregnancy and childbirth than white women.
This is writer Miriam Zoila Perez.
In certain places, that gap is even higher. So in New York City, for example, that rate is 12 times. Black women in New York City are 12 times more likely to die than white women in New York City during pregnancy and childbirth.
Why?
I mean, the answer that I've come to and a lot of people come to is racism. Is literally the way racism impacts people's bodies and their health and their well-being.
About 10 years ago, Miriam started working as a volunteer with pregnant women from a wide range of backgrounds.
And I was really interested in the anthropology of reproduction and read a lot about that. But then the reality of what women are experiencing in that I saw in the hospital context was so racialized in a way that academic study did not uncover.
Here's more from Miriam Zoila Perez on the TED stage.
African American women in particular have an entirely different experience than white women when it comes to whether their babies are born healthy. In certain parts of the country, particularly the Deep South, the rates of mother and infant death for black women actually approximate those rates in sub-Saharan Africa. In those same communities, the rates for white women are near zero. They're also twice as likely for their infants to die before the first year of life than white infants, and 2 to 3 times more likely to give birth too early or too skinny
a sign of insufficient development. Native women are also more likely to have higher rates of these problems than white women, as are some groups of Latinas. For the last decade, as a doula turned journalist and blogger, I've been trying to raise the alarm about just how different the experiences of women of color, but particularly black women, are when it comes to pregnancy and birth in the U.S. But when I tell people about these appalling statistics, I'm usually met with an assumption that it's about either poverty or lack of access to care. But it turns out neither of these things tell the whole story. Even middle-class black women still have much worse outcomes than their middle-class white counterparts. And while access to care is definitely still a problem, even women of color who receive the recommended prenatal care still suffer from these high rates. And so we come back to the path from discrimination to stress to poor health, and it begins to paint a picture that many people of color know to be true. Racism is actually making us sick. Still sound like a stretch? Consider this. Immigrants, particularly Black and Latina immigrants, actually have better health when they first arrive in the United States. But the longer they stay in this country, the worse their health becomes. People like me, born in the United States to Cuban immigrant parents, are actually more likely to have worse health than my grandparents did. It's what researchers call the immigrant paradox, and it further illustrates that there's something in the U.S. environment that is making us sick.
So the research that you found points to this idea that racism actually translates to physical symptoms and long-term health problems.
Right. So what we understand now is that discrimination actually has an impact on people's health through basically the nervous system, the mechanism of the nervous system. So when you experience the discrimination or the threat of discrimination, your body's flooded with hormones like cortisol and adrenaline that are really helpful when you're actually facing a life threat, but really have a sort of negative impact when it happens all of the time over long periods of time. So things like being concerned that you're going to get pulled over while driving your car, even just the threat of that creates like this feeling of nervousness. And I mean, people can relate to this, right? In the nervousness they have when, you know, they have to slam on their brakes really quickly or something, yeah. Or the nervousness they experience when they have a conflict with someone. Over time, that kind of fight or flight constant response actually weathers the systems that keep you healthy as well. And so that's kind of what people are starting to point to in understanding why these health disparities exist across lots of different health issues, not just maternal health.
So let's talk about an African-American mom in an American hospital who's four, in some cases, 12 times more likely to die in childbirth than a white mother about to give birth. What are some of the things that an African-American pregnant woman might face that would cause the possibility that she would die in childbirth?
So, I mean, I think you have to start like before she gets to the hospital, right? So it's what we were just talking about around people's experiences of people's broader life experiences and the challenges that folks face and the ways that race impacts how many more challenges and barriers and sort of difficult and stressful events does someone face. So one of the places you can look at it is high blood pressure. So you can kind of understand that maybe physiologically that if you're constantly under stress that your blood pressure might have a response. Well, preeclampsia, high blood pressure during pregnancy, can be really, really dangerous.
It can kill you.
It can kill you, right? So that's one of the things that we see higher rates of in African American women. I think it's also important to note that Native American women also face higher rates. They're sort of the second group. And then when it comes to Latinas, it depends on who you're talking about in the subgroups. And then white women have the best outcomes. And Asian women, again, tend to have better outcomes, but it does exist in other groups.
It seems to me that part of this goes back to your idea of the immigrant paradox, right? That it's about the environment.
Right.
Like you leave, you know, El Salvador and you had your mom and your sisters and your brothers and your uncles and aunts and you lived nearby. And then you manage to get across and you're alone and you're out of that supportive environment.
Right. But even people with their families here still struggle, right? So it's not just the immigrant traveling alone. But I do think that social support is a big piece of the puzzle. And that's where the individual model really goes to its worst, is that we not only do we not provide environments where pregnant women are supported, we also criminalize and penalize them for their actions. So you're seeing a rise in women being prosecuted for drug substance use during pregnancy, or even for the outcome of their pregnancy if they end up with a miscarriage, being criminally charged in places like Alabama, for example. But yeah, women are being criminalized for the choices they make during pregnancy. And you see that in certain states. And that's the exact opposite of what is ever going to help that person have a successful and healthy pregnancy, is criminalizing them and putting them in jail, which is a great context for a pregnant woman. Like, absolutely not, right? So you start to see, when we blame individuals for these situations, then we penalize them, and it's the exact opposite of what's going to make them healthier.
This problem that racism is making people of color, but especially Black women and babies, sick, is vast. I could spend all of my time with you talking about it, but I won't, because I want to make sure to tell you about one solution, the JJ way. Meet Jenny Joseph. She's a midwife in the Orlando, Florida area who's been serving pregnant women for over a decade. Her clients, most of whom are Black, Haitian, and Latina, deliver at the local hospital, but by providing accessible and respectful prenatal care, Jenny has achieved something remarkable. Almost all of her clients give birth to healthy, full-term babies. Her method is deceptively simple. Jenny says that all of her appointments start at the front desk. No one is turned away due to lack of funds. No one is chastised for showing up late to their appointments. No one is talked down to or belittled. Jenny's waiting room feels more like your aunt's living room than a clinic. When you finally are called back to your appointment, you're greeted by Alexis or Trina, two of Jenny's medical assistants. During one visit I observed, Trina chatted with a young, soon-to-be mom while she took her blood pressure. This Latina mom was having trouble keeping food down due to nausea. As Trina deflated the blood pressure cuff, she said, "We'll see about changing your prescription, okay? We can't have you not eating." That "we" is actually a really crucial aspect of Jenny's model. She sees her staff as part of a team that, alongside the woman and her family, has one goal: get mom to term with a healthy baby. This is a big departure from the traditional medical model because it places responsibility and information back in the woman's hands. So rather than a medical setting where you might be chastised for not keeping up with provider recommendations, the kind of settings often available to low-income women, Jenny's model is to be as supportive as possible. And that support provides a crucial buffer to the stress of racism and discrimination facing these women every day. But here's the best thing about Jenny's model. It's been incredibly successful. Remember those statistics I told you, that Black women are more likely to give birth too early, to give birth to low birth weight babies, to even die due to complications of pregnancy and childbirth? Well, the JJ way has almost entirely eliminated those problems, starting with what Jenny calls skinny babies. She's been able to get almost all her clients to term with healthy, chunky babies like this one. This is a baby girl born to a client of Jenny's this past June. So a similar demographic of women in Jenny's area who gave birth at the same hospital her clients did were 3 times more likely to give birth to a baby below a healthy weight. Jenny is making headway into what has been seen for decades as an almost intractable problem. It's a revolution in care just waiting to happen.
I mean, is the Jenny model, the Jenny Joseph model, can it happen? Can you imagine that model existing all over the United States?
This can work in any context. It's about the way that you treat people, and it's about access to the clinic, right? So I do think if we understood the interventions to these problems, understood this to be an intervention, it should be funded to the tune of millions of dollars, like a lot of other interventions are funded, right? If Jenny's model was a pill that you could take, it would be like the next big thing, right? But it's not a pill. And in some ways, it's more simple than a pill, but that's not the way that our system is set up to deal with these kinds of interventions. And they require people to create environments that are relatively free from bias, right? And that treat people of color with respect. And that's surprisingly, unfortunately, a really difficult thing right now.
That's Miriam Zoila Perez. She's a writer and the host of 2 podcasts, Radio Menea and Tonic. You can see her full talk at TED.com.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Your TV isn't broken, and there's no technical glitch. You're listening to nothing. And that's exactly how these protesters want it.
There's a culture of silencing, of denial, of not having the conversation, of no repercussions, no accountability from the current superintendent and principal.
Her daughter is a senior at Faith Christian Academy High School in Arvada, and graduation can't come soon enough.
Yeah, you call it a rough patch, yeah.
Because she says this is what school is like for her.
I've had, you know, kids call me the N-word all the time. I mean, that's probably not even the worst thing, honestly. Black lives don't matter. You're only smart because you're Asian. A teacher has called other children blackie, has said that women should be chained to the stove.
Racism, this family says it doesn't see anywhere else.
I've never really experienced it outside of faith.
So in January, one teacher put on a school assembly to address racism.
And that's when the firestorm started.
An open letter from that teacher after his assembly. He talked about how white students say they got the impression it was trying to guilt and shame them with phrases like white privilege.
A lot of the other kids were just saying how like offended they were, and they thought it was like inaccurate.
And that's when we're told parents demanded that teacher be fired.
One of the parents actually stood up and said, if I wanted diversity, I'd go to Manual High School.
In a letter to parents, the school said there were flaws in the delivery of the racism presentation, and it is committed to improve in the future. Well, Faith hasn't said why, it also let that teacher go.
I went to the principal as well, and I said, you can't fire the only person these children have to go to that's safe, that they trust, that they can talk to, because he tried to do something that was, in my opinion, really good.
That's why now they fight, hoping it's loud enough to silence the racism.
Now, of course, I did reach out to the school today. Now, when I talked to the secretary and told her why I was calling, she told me that she was instructed to only take down my name and number, and no one has called me back since. In Arvada, Ashley Michaels, Fox 31.
White girl, 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 white girl. I got you.
Both the defendant, Brianna Brochu, and her former roommate, Chanel Rowe, were in court today. And in court today, Rowe spoke out asking the judge to grant Brochu that second chance. She said she's hoping Brochu has learned from this, and she and her family are looking to move forward.
To this day, I find it hard to understand why Brianna did what she did to me.
Chanel Rose says she is still traumatized by what her former roommate is accused of doing to her belongings.
I worry about future health consequences. I have lost appetite. I cannot sleep.
Former UHART student Brianna Brochu is accused of smearing bodily fluids on Chanel Rowe's backpack, tampering with things like her lotion, and putting her toothbrush where, quote, the sun don't shine, according to an Instagram post. The judge granted Brochu's application for accelerated rehabilitation. This means charges of breach of peace and criminal mischief will be dismissed after 2 years if she completes the judge's requests.
I think it was a fair outcome. But at the end of the day, it's really going to boil down to how Brianna Brochu chooses to deal with this second chance.
While Rowe did not speak after the ruling, she offered this statement in court.
Because of my beliefs, I will not uphold Brianna's application for accelerated rehabilitation.
Supporters of Rowe, however, say Brochu should have been charged with a hate crime.
She had a plot. She carried it out, and then she bragged about it and had a celebration after she carried out her plan and said, I got rid of the Jamaican Barbie.
But the prosecutor said the state did not find evidence Brochu did this because of Chanel's race or ethnicity. Meanwhile, Paul Rowe says it has been a difficult time for his daughter and the entire family, but he says he knows his daughter is resilient and will bounce back from it.
She has a lot of drive. And I know for sure that this may be a bump in the road, but it will not stop her from achieving what she wants to achieve.
Now, Brochu did not speak in court, but her lawyer says she understands what she did was wrong.
She knows that she made a mistake, and I think Your Honor can be extremely confident that Ms. Rotu will never be here in front of the court again.
Now, Brochu's conditions include paying Rose out-of-pocket expenses from that incident. She will also have to perform 200 hours of community service by October 1st, 2019, 100 of which must be with a literacy organization and a social services group. Aishabo, Fox 61 News.
We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and eight others knew all of this history. But he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. An act that he imagined would incite fear.
So many of you at home are likely going to recognize Dylan Roof's picture. Deputies say this is his sister, Morgan Roof, who was taken into custody after bringing drugs, pepper spray, and a knife to her South Carolina high school. And that is not all. Investigators say the 18-year-old also posted a message to Snapchat that alarmed fellow students as they were participating in the national school walkout that we saw yesterday. According to ABC News, several media outlets say that that post read, "I hope it's a trap and you all get shot." Roof was arrested yesterday after a school administrator called a school resource officer. The school also posted a letter to parents explaining what had happened on campus. This is Dylan Roof. You may remember he was convicted of shooting and killing nine parishioners at a Charleston church 3 years ago. Morgan Roof is now charged with marijuana possession and also two counts of carrying weapons on school grounds. Her bond set at $5,000.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
Okay, thanks a lot there, David. The man convicted of killing former NFL player Joe McKnight will spend the next 30 years in prison. A judge sentenced Ronald Gasser today after McKnight's family and a close friend read tearful impact statements. As Kimberly Kirk reports, they asked the judge for the maximum sentence.
Joe McKnight's family says they believe justice was served.
A little relief to knowing that he's going to be behind bars because we know Joe is not coming back. But that's the pain I have to live with on a daily basis.
6 weeks ago, a jury found Ronald Gasser guilty of manslaughter for the shooting death of the former NFL player and John Curtis standout. McKnight was killed after a road rage incident between the two on December 1, 2016 in Tarrytown. Gasser's defense attorney said his client still maintains he acted in self-defense.
Enough is enough. They keep trying to find a justification, and there is no justification for taking somebody's life. There's nothing that will ever bring Joe back. Jaden will never have that in his life, have him back in his life.
Gasser didn't speak at his sentencing hearing Thursday, but the prosecution argued he has shown no remorse and still believes his actions were justified. The judge sentenced Gasser to 30 years of hard labor at the Department of Corrections after saying the tragedy could have been easily avoided.
For me, it was just like, take it. Accept it. Accept that you're wrong. You were still not accepting that you were wrong. You were still you and your team still believe that what you did was justified and that it is okay.
Before sentencing, McKnight's family asked the judge to give Gasser the maximum sentence of 40 years. While reading her victim impact statement, McKnight's mother was overcome with tears, but she looked right at the man convicted of killing her son and said, "My child is not coming home. You took that from me."
I wanted to face him. I wanted him to see the pain that I'm feeling from day one up down to 20 years from now. I'm going to still feel that pain because he was my child.
The defense asked for a new trial, but the judge denied that request. Gasser's attorney had no comment as he left the courthouse today. Liz.
It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs.
We've been following breaking news all day across Austin. Police say two explosions today and one earlier this month are all related.
There is no obvious connection between the victims, their neighborhoods, or their neighbors. But police say the devices and the circumstances are just too similar to ignore. Interim Police Chief Brian Manley had this warning this evening.
If you receive a suspicious package, then call us and let us come out, because a device like this can be hidden in many different ways. And so it's important, again, if you're not expecting a delivery and yet one shows up and it's not from someone that you do business with or that you were expecting, it's important that you call us.
KXAN's Brittany Glass is near the home on Galindo Street with the latest on the explosion.
But we begin with Aaron Cargill, who's live near Old Fort Hill Drive, where the first explosion happened today. Aaron.
Cindy and Robert, this neighborhood street, it has been blocked off all day long since 7 this morning. Investigators, local, state, federal, they are still out here. A 17-year-old boy died in his home along this street. Neighbors tell us he was in high school and he was very active in church. Those same neighbors tell me it was his mother who was injured, doing something most of us don't even think twice about.
A tragic start to spring break. A family waking up to find a package on their front porch, taking it inside and triggering an explosion.
Very scary, just shot in total shock, because I couldn't. The next thing I knew, I saw ambulance with my neighbor on, you know, on the stretcher.
Cynthia Burdett is a family friend who lives across the street and heard the blast.
It was just a loud, loud boom. And, you know, just couldn't figure out what it was.
Police are confident Monday's bomb did not come through the mail or any official delivery service. Instead, they think someone hand-delivered it overnight and was similar to the one that killed a man on his porch 10 days ago. The victims, all minorities.
We cannot rule out that hate crime is at the core of this, but we're not saying that that's the cause as well.
Now neighbors are rallying around the family caught off guard.
But prayers are needed for the family.
And keeping a close eye on their own doorsteps.
And I know you're at home wondering, what did these packages look like? We asked police. We also asked them, what exactly was that explosive device? They know the answer, but they're not sharing those details right now because they want to find out exactly who did that, and that could hurt this investigation. Also, earlier today, I spoke with a good friend of the family. I'll have her thoughts for you tonight at 6. Back to you.
Aaron, thank you. 10 minutes south of there, authorities say a woman has life-threatening injuries after a third explosion on Galindo Street this morning. Our Brittany Glass is live there. Brittany.
Well, Robert, at last report, Austin police say the victim is at the hospital, listed in critical but stable condition. We also know now that the victim is a 75-year-old Hispanic woman. What is now the third package explosion in a matter of 10 days detonated shortly before noon today in the 6700 block of Galindo Street in southeast Austin. Police, fire, and EMS responded to the call, and the area has seen a heavy law enforcement presence that includes federal agents ever since. APD Chief Brian Manley says in this incident, it does not appear the woman actually opened the package.
The victim in this incident came outside of her residence and found a package out front, and she picked up that package, and at that point the explosion, the box detonated. So we again are praying and thinking of her and hoping for a recovery from this incident.
The victim's identity has not yet been released at this time. The immediate area, as you can tell behind me, is still blocked off to the public. In fact, it's still blocked off to homeowners who live on Galindo Street who were not here at the time of the explosion. Those who were are allowed to stay inside their homes. We'll bring you the latest information on this explosion as soon as it becomes available. Reporting live in southeast Austin, Brittany Glass, KXAN News.
The New York Times
editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy.
Following a developing story out of Independence, homes evacuated after a suspicious package was found at a home.
Let's get out to 41 Action News reporter Sarah Plake live for us. So Sarah, what have you learned?
Well, the package didn't turn out to be dangerous, but still alarming for the woman who lives here. She told me the package contained a racial slur and a black Barbie doll and said it's the act of a coward. Miss Linda said that she checked her mail earlier this morning and said she saw a package wrapped in Christmas paper. She turned it over and noticed the N-word written on the back. She alerted the mailman, who was still in the neighborhood, and they alerted Independence Police. They sent in their bomb squad unit to investigate and evacuated surrounding homes just to be on the safe side. They x-rayed the package and determine it was not a threat, but will not confirm what was inside of it yet. Miss Linda only had one reaction.
Stupid. And I have a grandbaby here. And that's her job to get the mail. And that's when I broke down. Okay. I broke down and cried and I thank God for the Holy Spirit that sent me to that mailbox and not her.
And we heard about the recent Austin package explosions. Police tell me that if anybody suspects a suspicious package, to back away immediately and call police. And Independence, I'm Sarah Plake, 41 Action News.
I just want, do you remember when Dylan Stormwolf shot up the church, Mother Emanuel Church? And around that same time, I believe like within the 24-48 hour period, it was like 11 black institutions that were either bombed, including, I think, the NAACP office. But it was a bunch of churches, some that just got shot through them. A couple had been spray painted or damaged in some way. Do you remember that?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I particularly remember the church shooting, yes.
Oh, okay. So I just wanted to—I was just framing the framework just to ask if we're in the middle of a race war right now.
5 murders in 3 states since last May at first glance seemed like isolated cases. Then a common thread started to emerge. 3 young men have been charged. All appear to have links to the same white supremacist group. NPR's Greg Myrie has our report.
The group calls itself the Atomwaffen Division. Atomwaffen is German for atomic weapons. It celebrates Adolf Hitler and Charles Manson. Its online images are filled with swastikas, and it promotes violence.
Race war now.
This Atomwaffen video shows young men in face scarves and camouflage firing rifles during military-style training. It concludes with the tagline, "Join your local Nazis."
Atomwaffen no doubt takes some of the white supremacist rhetoric to another level. The views that they articulate is white supremacists on steroids.
Joanna Mendelson follows extremist groups for the Anti-Defamation League in Los Angeles.
And what is the change that they want to see? Real-world violence, real-world apocalyptic violence.
In the public conversation about extremism, radical Islam gets most of the attention. But according to monitoring groups, right-wing extremists have carried out a similar number of killings over the past 15 years. Atomwaffen was founded 3 years ago. One member says about 60 people belong nationwide. They hide their identities and may not know each other beyond online pseudonyms, though some have gathered for weapons training. And Atomwaffen keeps popping up in the news.
This morning, the Orange County District Attorney's Office filed 1 felony count of murder.
Prosecutors say 20-year-old Sam Woodward stabbed to death 19-year-old Blaze Bernstein on January 2nd in Orange County, California. They had attended high school together and apparently went to a park on the night of the killing.
Bernstein was Jewish and openly gay. He was back home for winter break from the University of Pennsylvania. Here's Bernstein's father, Gideon, describing the son he lost.
Blaze was a brilliant, colorful, and charismatic man who shined light on all of the lives of the people and communities that he touched.
According to the news outlet ProPublica, Woodward was an Atomwaffen member who attended one of his training camps. Group members are supporting him on social media. This is one of three separate attacks and a total of five deaths with apparent links to Atomwaffen. Keegan Hanke studies far-right groups for the Southern Poverty Law Center.
All of these young men, steeped in this propaganda both online and off, went on to enact violence. You know, I think the fact that so much of it came to light in a short period of time shows how devastatingly potent some of these materials can be.
In Reston, Virginia, just outside Washington, police say a couple was fatally shot in December by their daughter's 17-year-old boyfriend. The shooting took place after the couple told their daughter to break up with the boy when they learned of his neo-Nazi beliefs, reportedly linked to Atomwaffen. Then there's this case in Florida.
Right now at 5, a double murder motive. The disturbing comments a teenager made to police explaining...
18-year-old Devin Arthurs is charged with killing two roommates in Tampa last May. He told police he was an Atomwaffen member and, bizarrely, also a convert to Islam. He's pleaded not guilty, but during police interrogation, he claimed he acted to prevent attacks Atomwaffen members were plotting.
In hindsight, it's very stupid what I've done. And honestly, like, it feels almost like, all of this feels very surreal, like a dream.
Another roommate, 22-year-old Brandon Russell, is a leading member of Atomwaffen. In a separate case, he was sentenced in January to 5 years for possessing explosives. Atomwaffen is just one of many white supremacist groups that gathered last year in Charlottesville, Virginia, for a rally that turned violent. Here again is the ADL's Joanna Mendelson.
I've been doing this work for 17 years, and not to be hyperbolic in any way, but we've never been as busy as we are today. The white supremacists are much more emboldened.
They're no longer on the fringes, she says. Now they want to be mainstream. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
Have you ever heard of the movie City of God?
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen it, but, you know, that's supposed to be, you know, sending a message to somebody about, hey, you know, color does make a difference.
A vigil has been taking place in Rio de Janeiro following the killing of a Brazilian politician who had campaigned against police brutality. Mariela Franco was shot several times in the head on Wednesday night by an unknown gunman. A Rio State representative, Marcelo Freixo, said her death needs to be investigated properly.
The characteristics are of an execution. We have to resolve this as soon as possible, not for each one of us, but for Rio de Janeiro. This is completely inadmissible. A person full of life, full of desire, a fundamental person for Rio de Janeiro, who was brutally murdered.
A short time ago, I spoke to our correspondent, Julia Carnero, who was still at the vigil at the time, and asked her what the atmosphere was like.
Well, there are thousands of people protesting here in the central area, right next to the iconic Church of Candelaria. This is where the mass demonstrations of 2013 were held here in Rio, and today brings memories back of those days with lots of people taking to the streets to protest against the murder of this politician. This is already wrapping up after a long vigil held here in downtown following her coffin. Her burial already happened this afternoon, and now people are still paying tribute to her.
Tell us about Mariela Franco. She was known for her campaigns against police brutality.
Yes, against police brutality and also against racism, machismo. She's a feminist. She's a black woman, which makes her a rare appearance in the political scenery in Brazil that's dominated by white male politicians. She comes from the favelas of Rio, the shantytown. She has really poor upbringing, and she made it through. She managed to go to university She got a master's degree, so she has quite an extraordinary trajectory. And her history was really a mark of the politics that she was trying to implement in defense of these minorities, of groups that don't really get much attention here in Rio, that live in the poor slums and are often victim of police violence. So there is police, the main line of investigation is that she was probably executed. She was shot in the head 4 times. And one of the rumors that are still, this is still speculation, people do think, though, that it could have to do with some kind of police reprisal against her political activity, but there are still other powerful groups that could be responsible for this, so it's still early to say.
Julia Carneiro in Brazil.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 17th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, observations. Certainly if you have commentary on any of the clips that we just heard, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A couple things before we get to the listeners. First and foremost, thankfully, the iTunes feed updated yesterday. All of the programs from 2018, since we've been back on the air from the flood, are available in the iTunes feed, obviously, except for the current broadcast, but hopefully that'll be added as soon as we end the broadcast later today. But everything, the broadcast from yesterday, from the book club, all of the Hate U Give book study sessions are in the iTunes feed now. All of the other podcast sites that update from iTunes or wherever they update from the feed, all of those should update as well. So if you had any difficulties accessing any of the programs from the month of March, that should be resolved. I do know that some of the older programs from 2014, 2013, some of those programs in the iTunes feed are not working, and I'm trying to go through and check and replace the ones where it's not working and get the correct audio uploaded. But that's taken some time, obviously, to go through hundreds of archives to check to see what's working. I think that could be an act of white supremacy racism as well. We've had lots of sabotage through the years here at the COWS, but at least for the current episodes, they are available at iTunes. Hopefully that will remain. That'll be the case. We won't have any more of these problems, at least for a few minutes, weeks, whatever we can get. Pressing forward. Next, this broadcast, listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, the PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported us. 9 years of the COWS. I hope non-white listeners have got constructive information about what it means to be white, what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and things that we can do to get this problem solved immediately. Also, you can support nabbing items from the wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. My wish list is linked at the blog as well. I'll Facebook it and tweet it as well. But thanks for all the folks who've nabbed items for their sympathy for the flood disaster and or just supporting the broadcast. Super appreciated. And again, hope the broadcast, the COWS, worthy of your time and energy. Also, wanted to point out the segment that was talking about how racism impacts pregnant black mothers. And we had Darlene Turner on the program right end of 2017. We had a couple programs addressing that subject matter. I know some listeners took the position that they think this is propaganda. They don't think that black females are experiencing all of this stress and turmoil during pregnancy. They think that this is just being promoted by racists in the similar manner that they will promote other lies, fabrications, to just say that, oh, everything is horrible and wrong with black. Like, they'll say that only black people have sickle cell, which is not true at all. But they'll say it's very common. I think that's even been said on this program by some victims of racism, because racists have been so effective at promoting that lie. Do folks think that that is true? What's being reported, that because of white supremacy, racism, that a lot of black mothers have difficulty in pregnancy, even leading to high rates of black maternal mortality? Or do people think that that is a fabrication? I do remember some people were very, some Cal's listeners were very passionate in saying that they think all of that is just racist propaganda, and saying that it's been promoted a lot recently. I can say since September, we'll say since autumn of 2017, that subject, that topic, has been talked about in many more mainstream outlets. They just had the TED Talk on the subject matter, WNYC, which is New York Public Radio. They just had a big segment, the LA Times. They did two different reports back in right toward the end of 2017. Like, I have seen over the past, as I said, it's about 7 months, I have seen a lot more coverage of this subject matter in mainstream outlets. That is noteworthy. Continuing, I also wanted to make sure I got in a comment about the importance of believing that a problem can be solved. Talking about, we've been on the air for 9 years. This is something that first came up years back. I think our very first year on the air, the documentary Ma'afa 21, which interestingly is about the attack on black babies, black pregnancy in the system of white supremacy, and given a historical perspective. Anywho, when we had the suspected race soldier who put that documentary film together, one of the things that he talked about that was kind of tangentially related to his project was that when you have people convinced that a problem cannot be solved, frequently that impacts how they think, how they go about the business of attempting to solve the problem. If they don't think it can be solved, they will lollygag, they'll be a little bit lazy, they won't really put their full effort into reaching a solution because they don't really think that the problem can be solved. Whereas if people believe that the problem can be solved, they'll work hard, they'll really give it their all, try to do their absolute best to get that solution. He said that they, you know, they've done research on this, they've done studies. And even if they didn't have reports to corroborate, I can see that in my own experience. I was just this week kind of low-key bragging about being able to accomplish my first handstand. That right there, I did not think in my yoga practice, I did not think I could do a headstand for various reasons. And I had non-white instructor. I've talked about that before, the importance of having a non-white yoga instructor to be encouraging and supportive and all the things that you typically would not get from race soldiers in any context, yoga or no. But to have a non-white instructor who was very supportive, very encouraging, and she believed I could do the headstand when I did not. That is definitely applicable to racism, white supremacy. And I had thought about that for a while because, I mean, I've brought this up on the program before about the importance of believing that a problem can be solved and how that applies to racism. I have concluded most of the non-white people on the planet, they do not think the problem of racism, white supremacy can be solved. Now, they might not state it as explicitly as that, but they do not. And even the people, and like I said, I've just come to a conclusion. What I'm saying, it could be true, it could be false. You'll have the process come to your own conclusion. But when people make statements like they say that racism, white supremacy, Oh, man, it's going to take a long time. It might take 10,000 years. Like we've heard people on this program, guests, white and non-white, say that. Might take 10,000 years. Might take 50,000 years. Might take 100,000 years. You heard some of that in the audio clips. Not going to solve it this generation. Who knows? Maybe 5, 6, 10, 20 generations. In my view, all of that I process as this problem, racism, white supremacy, cannot be solved. The best we can do is hope that maybe sometime way down the road, infinitely in the future, maybe things will be better or this problem won't be here. But, you know, for the time being, it's going to be around. That just means this problem can't be solved. And you, in my view, you see that articulated in many other ways in terms of how people think we should go about dealing with this problem. Maybe even the appeals to be friendly with whites, I think, is connected to the idea that this problem can't be solved. I think one of the major jobs of counter-racists, yes, this problem can be solved. And your belief that this problem can be solved will have to compensate for many, 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 many other victims of white supremacy who do not think this problem can be solved. That is exactly what happened with my headstand non-white instructor. She believed when I did not believe, and she had enough belief and she had logic. That's the other important piece. She didn't just sit on the side and say, "Oh, Brother Gus, I think you can do it. I'm going to pray for you." She had the logic, the mechanics of this is how you build to do a headstand. And you do this until you get strong enough and maybe are not intimidated anymore about the whole process to do it. Same applies to counter-racism. These are the mechanics to going about the business of ending replacing white supremacy with justice. Some of the simple things, not name calling other black people, doing as much as we can to minimize conflict with other non-white people, being suspicious of white people, asking for definitions, having a definition of racism, white supremacy, just the mechanics of putting racist man, racist woman, racist child out of business and building the belief that, yes, this problem can be solved. And there are things that we can be doing right now that will build to solving this problem. But I thought that was really, really important, something that has to be paid attention to and maybe something that should be emphasized more. This problem can be solved. Dr. Welsing, she used to emphasize that when she came on this program and many, many other times when she spoke, she would emphasize this problem can be solved. And she did not have a timetable of 10,000 years or 50,000 years or 1,000 years. She felt this problem could be solved in short order with codification, correct understanding of racism, white supremacy, and just accurate application of logic. She believed that. I think that is the case as well. Just maybe, I guess, one counter-racist suggestion, make a point of emphasizing this problem can be solved, and it can be solved much more quickly than most people think. We should not be thinking, or at least I'll put it this way, and then I can leave this point alone. I don't typically hear when they are talking about the environment and going green, and they talk about all of that and being sustainable. I don't hear timelines of, oh man, by the year 5,000, maybe we'll be sustainable. I don't hear that. When they talk about any other major project, when they talk about all their exploration that they want to do in the known universe, and we're going to end up on this planet, I don't hear timelines that are, oh man, might take us, you know, 10,000, 50,000 years, but one of these, I don't hear that. They are about it. 10 years, we got this. 5 years, we got this. That's the same way that we should be approaching the problem of racism, white supremacy, and perhaps a point of emphasis. This problem can be solved. Next, this broadcast, compensatory call-in, I consistently request that we not use metaphors on the weekend, even in the broadcast and this from some of the sound clips. Michelle Norris, she used to work at NPR, did the race card, or she is doing the race card project, when she was talking about white people, that it doesn't all get chalked up to racism. Some of it is economic uncertainty and where the country is going and technology and all this other. Lots of onions in that stew. You always get all these interesting metaphors with racism, white supremacy. I contend that when we're talking about this serious problem, those types of metaphors, they do not help us get clarity, which is what is needed to solve problems. We want to be explicit, exact with what we're talking about and not get loose, careless with invoking of metaphors. I've concluded that racists, they do this a lot of times deliberately to spread confusion. They will compare, contrast things that are not equivalent. They will do this deliberately as a form of being master deceivers. It is a major technique of deception to just throw things out in a confusing manner or to say things in a manner where you are comparing, suggesting that two entities are the same or equivalent when they are not. And they do this regularly. Non-white people, we've been exposed to this behavior for years. We are victims of white supremacy, Gus T. included. We are still learning. Sometimes we will insert a metaphor or analogy, simile, in place of logic when we, you know, are talking about a concept or theme where we are still thinking we haven't come to a conclusion. Sometimes it's best to just stop and say, let me think about this a little longer until I get my words correct, the logic correct to articulate myself, as opposed to using a metaphor when that might just add to confusion. And that's something we should be trying to minimize as well. I will definitely prompt about the metaphors as we proceed. If folks could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, whatever it is that you want to present. If you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. It helps preserve the audio quality of the program. We don't have to worry about car noises or the television, or if you got other people talking in the background, just whatever you would like to share with us, and then mute your line. And then if you have additional comments, once everybody gets their one turn, you can unmute yourself and, you know, whatever else you want to add to the discussion. Much obliged for that as well. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I guess one other quick question that I would ask, in addition to the black pregnancy trauma question, with the bombings in Texas, I got the impression that that did not really get very much coverage. I could be in error. I know, you know, they did talk about it somewhat, but I did not get the impression, like when there have been other incidents that they deem to be terrorism or bombing, certainly where you had, you know, fatalities, more than one, I did not get the impression that this was like major news happening in Austin, Texas. If I'm in error, if people felt like that, you know, did get a lot of coverage and that a lot of people were talking about that this week, then I would appreciate folks correcting me on that as well. That said, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening, Gus.
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
How are you, sir? I know right poorly. Just wanted to give some. I'll tell you that they didn't make a big deal out of that story in New York. It's just becoming a story where they're saying, oh, this might be a case of racism, but they still need to do some investigating. So I think that should tell you if this is the media capital and they're not making a big deal out of that story. Man, the rising anxiety of white people. I feel so bad for the white people, Gus. Then they said, like you just said, 3 to 4 to 5 generations. You know, I said this on the show before. This technology they're coming out with is going to cause more racism than anything. I mean, I would say, and I'm not using a metaphor, but more racism than what was experienced after the end of slavery, when you have white people without no jobs and no one to blame. You can't blame a computer, can't blame a robot, you know. It's going to come back around to us. And I fear that. National Geographic, this is an organization that's paid to push a eugenics out of Africa series, which splits the world at that time into half, right at the desert, the Sahara Desert, and made everything below that savages, black, you know, considered black country or sub-Saharan. Everything above that, including ancient Egypt, was white. That's how they've, that whole society has been going forward. So, yeah, it doesn't shock me. National Geographic, they're hiding a lot of things, and I don't think they want black people to know. The 2020 census, I think it could be a trap. However, we're the only race on the planet that for 50 years has the same percentage of people, which I think is a lie. And I would like to see an accurate count of the 2020 census to see just how many black people are in this country, or people who are identified as black by the government. And I would like to think that if they say we have 44 million, I think it's more like 70. Those numbers about the racism and the birth rates. Now, one thing, the lady who was doing the talking, she put the blacks into a group, she put whites into a group, she put Latinos from some countries. So it was Latinos from some groups of Latinos, my bad, that's what she said, I wrote it down. And I just thought that was very interesting, because it's like she split up her own group. When they said women from Africa and Latin America, which are third world countries, come to America, and then they start doing worse health-wise than they were when they got here. It was a movie, a documentary that came out a few years ago called Super Size Me. And there was this guy, he went to all kinds of doctors, got checked out, but he did 30 days straight of eating McDonald's. And he went back to the same doctors and they said, you're dying. Like, you got to stop eating what you're eating. His health was totally deteriorated. That's what this system does to you. It's not so much you have more access to more foods and everything once you get here, but the stress of the racism, white supremacy, it just eats you alive. And I hate to say that, it's just a metaphor. It eats at you. It destroys you. A good friend of mine's Mel, who calls in sometimes, he calls it current traumatic stress disorder. And that's what we all have, a whole bunch of these disorders that are still ongoing. The walk out of school, I equate this to all these kids who are allowed to walk out of school for 17 minutes and hold hands in solidarity and lay down on lawns. And let's compare that to those kids who left school to a barrage of police force in Baltimore, and the mother of the year had to go and grab her son and pull him away. But look at the difference in treatment. When these kids want to protest, even though it was much more organized, not as emotional, but you see the force that they were met with. And if I recall, those kids didn't walk out of school. They were dismissed from school, and the police were already there, already anticipating they were going to do something. But I always see a big difference. The Jamaican Barbie, to me, that should be a hate crime. If I hit someone and call them a Jewish whatever or a Zionist this, it happens in New York all the time. They charge that black person who hit a Jewish person and called them Jewish before they did it with a hate crime. And I think that Jamaican Barbies, that should definitely count as a hate crime. The package explosions, black people are the most surveilled people in the country, and we have the most police enforced neighborhoods, and they can't find any clues to this. And the very last thing, the murderous neo-Nazi groups and all of these groups that made this list of hate groups, and they put the black groups on there. They had all the branches of the Nation of Islam, all the branches of Dr. York's Nuwapians, all the Hebrew Israelite branches, a few of the Moorish branches, and a whole bunch of black bookstores. That's their terrorist groups. And I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Waiting to see Gus T. Renegade's name on the list. Do we have other folks who had commentary that we've not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard?
I heard both of you. We'll nab the female caller first.
Sure.
Greetings, everyone. To answer your first question, Gus, about whether or not I think it's true that the Black women are dying more from childbirth and that Black people overall have a higher birth rate, I think that there's enough evidence to suggest that that's not only true, but that it's biologically logical. Primarily because, and I guess this will tie into the first clip that you played, which I'm very, very happy that you played, about exercise. I'm currently studying a bunch of math and science courses, and in these science courses, I'm able to learn about how particular molecules can affect gene expression. And all of these molecules are influenced, not all of them like 100%, but primarily by the environment. If I have a response to something, it floods my body with particular hormones, or ligands is what, you know, they're called in case they're not hormones, but like cortisol, like epinephrine, which is adrenaline. And these stress hormones are, by their nature, by the way that they are, small enough to actually enter into the cell, not just the cell, but even go into the nucleus. And because they're able to go into the nucleus, they actually bind to particular parts of the DNA. When they do that, they actually control whether or not certain proteins are produced. And those proteins is what we call gene expression. So yes, I do think, like, it would be illogical to say that the stress that Black people in general and Black women specifically are under, because we can also consider the stress of the Black male. And so that stress, as males actually produce their gametes, or their half of the egg, their sperm, they produce that more often. Women are born, they say, with all the eggs that we're ever going to have. So our eggs do actually still get, the genes in them still get affected, but the men's happen, or, you know, more often because they produce the sperm more often. So we should, I think, consider that as well in terms of the effects on the child. That notwithstanding, it would be illogical to assume that higher levels of stress and flooding the system with chronic stress hormones don't lead to chronic disease states at a genetic cellular level that then don't impact, that, you know, don't impact how well that person, that female, is able to carry and birth a child. Because in addition to whatever hormones she's flooding in her system at a constant rate, we would still have to consider the epigenetic stress predisposition that she was born with, that her mother gave to her and the mothers before gave to. And I think that it just makes absolute scientific logic to assume that you can reach a threshold to where maybe we were able to withstand it, particularly also tying back into the first clip that you played, exercise. I cannot say it enough. I maintain at this point that exercise is the, like, health antidote to racism, white supremacy experienced at a physiological level for non-white, specifically Black people, even with the exception of food. If your food is not good, but you're exercising, you're actually still able to get much, much healthier benefits. Anyway, all of that to say, yeah, there's enough evidence to suggest that that is absolutely true. And I think in Mr. Fuller says in one of his clips, I'm trying to make sure I'm not long-winded and that I'm clear about what I'm saying. Mr. Fuller also said in one of the talks that he had given, he said, you know, master deceivers are so good. That's when you know that you are just so good that you confuse the person so much that when you finally tell them the truth, they don't believe you. And I think that is what's happening here. I'll try to just mention like a couple of things else, but that was really the most important thing. I think it's particularly, I wanted to say with the wanting to get more specific in the census, I think that that's very dangerous because I think it's gonna lead to further polarization, isolation. And what I heard was that continental Africans are ready to definitely, like, politically, you know, with labels separate themselves from Black Americans, which means that, you know, if they're able to do that, who knows what access all these, you know, jobs and resources or whatever will be able to separate. We'll say, oh, well, this is a continental African Black person. This is one of our, you know, locally homegrown Black people who we don't, you know, we don't rock with any of them or we don't respect any of them, but we definitely don't like the local Black homegrown one. And what that made me think about was, did this occur? It's a question I'm going to research later. Did this occur in Nazi Germany? You know, how far did their political categories and labels go into how they classified people? I do know, you know, with they said people were Jews and all that, but were there maybe like different separations or whatever, which then made me think about a quote that's in the Holocaust Museum, which I don't have the exact quote, but it states pretty much that first they came for these people and I didn't say anything. Then they came for these other people. I didn't say anything. Then they came for me and nobody's here for me. So I wonder, you know, that's all. There's an increased direct violence. We're not ready and we're extremely vulnerable. But I agree with Gus 100%. I was going to say something like 200%, but there's really no such thing as that. 100% that the problem can and will be solved. And speaking to that, I didn't hear anything about the bombings in Texas other than the fact that I've been making sure that I read a lot of news. But no, there isn't a lot of coverage, which is so dangerous because those are direct war, like, direct violence, that's war. Like, I think to answer, I think it was Thomas's questions, which I thought was a perfect question to ask Dr. Kevorkian. Are we at war and Black people just don't know it? I think the answer is yes. And then the last thing, just because I may not speak again, in case people don't know where to get their news, there's an app called Feedly, and then you can feed all of your blogs and go to like all the different news places to feed it all in so you can make sure that you're getting a lot of news. So thank you all for listening.
Appreciate that, Emmy. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? I've got a couple comments. Gus, I didn't hear any of the clips, but was there a segment about sickle cell? I heard someone mention that.
I mentioned sickle cell, but there was not a segment that talked about sickle cell.
Oh, okay. I see. One thing, I heard some stuff about National Geographic. One thing I've noticed with them is that they are a propaganda machine. And this is going back to what Thomas was saying. They like to take out Black people from the history of North Africa. And it's very dangerous because if we don't know part of that history, we don't know how we got to this point. And so, for instance, they'll make statues of like King Tut, and he looks like a white person. But now these same white people did a DNA test of him, and his closest match are Southern Africans, then Central Africans, then West Africans, then East Africans. And he also had sickle cell too, which is really interesting. So, you know, this is the type of deception they play in terms of history. And I noticed that I heard Dr. Ivan Van Sertima talk about these types of publications. They'll go to the most remote places in like Africa and study like the most quote unquote primitive people. So the hunter gatherers, the people who just live off the land completely. And what's interesting is that Dr. Sertima was saying that you can find places just like that in Europe with white people. But you notice that the whites and their organizations, they never do documentaries about the people who live out of huts in Europe. And I've noticed that it's just a way to make Black people look primitive. They don't go to cities, you know, the typical centers where you would see large amounts of people. Like, they don't do documentaries on Timbuktu like they do on hunter-gatherers in some part of the desert in Africa. I just find all that interesting, and I think it's like another part of the system. I had a workplace with racism incident. I just wanted to update about the situation I'm in. I'm a black male caller that works in the technology field with airplanes, and I was just calling in regards to, I'm still noticing the pattern of how whites are still trying to sabotage multi-million dollar equipment just so a black person will not learn any valuable skills on the job. And it can get dangerous because if you're signing things out and it has your name on it, the whites, when they're reviewing it, they might let certain things go. And your name has been signed off on the work product. So if something were to happen or someone were to die, you can possibly get in trouble for that. But the final reviewer's job is to make sure that any of the small details are found and are taken care of. So as a black person, it's very important for you, if you're working in any field where you have command of people's lives, that you overstand the material 3-4 times better than the next person, because you honestly cannot trust the white's opinion in terms of whether or not something is right or wrong. And that's it for now.
Workplace Racism, Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Workplace Racism, very important, I think, suggestions about making sure that you are extra competent when you know that you're working with race soldiers who are sabotaging your efforts. And I think that's important, too, because I think a lot of times we get confused about white supremacy racism, what it means to be classified as white. We think, you know, they have priorities. We think they have many other priorities, money, sex, lots of other things that are more important than white supremacy racism. That is false. White supremacy racism, top priority. And as you stated, that right there would seem to evidence the point that they're willing to destroy, you know, very expensive equipment as long as it causes problems for Negroes. Very important point, I think, and great reminder. I'm going to make sure that I am safe in this environment, because that just seems so reckless that, oh man, I'm going to make my personal safety top priority, and I'm going to make sure I'm extra competent at my jobs and duties. That will go back to priority one, making sure that you keep yourself safe. Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Thursdays. Other folks have commentary for this evening? If you have a hand up, line should be open.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. A few things about the black women and the infant mortality rates. I think that is true. I agree with the reasons Emmy said. And yes, it's being highlighted. And I think it's being highlighted to scare black women into not having children. Or, you know, they say there are a lot of older black women or a lot of single black women who don't have children. And it's like, see, this is why you shouldn't have children, because this type of thing can happen to you. So I think it's a scare tactic. It is happening, and I think it's also a scare tactic into making sure that they don't have children. The segmentation of the black designation, I definitely do believe that it's racist. I know other black people may not identify with the quote unquote African American experience through slavery and all that, but if you're going to do it for that group, you need to do it for the white group. Where are you from? Italy, this, that, and the other. And the fact that you're not doing that, you're purposely trying to divide that population. Three, the book that we're reading. The book group, well, that I'm listening to, because I don't think I could sit there and read that, that we're listening to, there is a cottage industry. It is so much bigger than we're just reading this book. There are study plans out there that people have written for this book. This book in itself has become part of the industry of, you know, oh, poor black people, oh, this, that, whatever that industry is called. And what else do I have to say? Oh, one thing, this kind of unrelated. I do like that mystery shopping stuff, and I can send you a link to the email to send to people. Now, you can't do this to earn a living, but you can get, like, free stuff here and there plus the extra $10 or $15. You know, if you're going to go to that place anyway, you know, you might as well get paid. So that's all. Yes, that's all for now. Thank you.
Right on. Constructive info. You don't get on the, in the book she's talking about is Angie Thomas's The Hate You Give. We just started it the week before last. We've done two sessions. They are all in the iTunes archive now, and SoundCloud and YouTube and Black Talk Radio Network and, you know, wherever else. But we've only read we've done two sessions. I think we were on chapter 7, I think. But next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have children that are in middle school or up, might be worth checking out. Your child might have to read this filth. Yikes. Other folks, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Yeah, this is Ken Steele. I'm calling in from Los Angeles, and I wanted to just make a few comments. First, on the census story. On that story, Black people, in my belief, I don't have stats to back this up, but just from my observations in moving around the country, Black people are definitely undercounted. And depending on what you classify as Black, I think that the presence of non-white people in this country is far greater than what is being counted on these so-called official rolls. I've never myself participated in any census counting. I've never been approached to participate in a census. I've never had a census taker come to, you know, my door and start asking questions about, you know, how many Negroes are in the house. I've never witnessed this myself. I've never turned in any sort of census documentation. So I know there's at least one Black person that's not being counted. So I think that there's definitely a lot more that are being that are not being counted. And then the idea that Black is being segmented. Now I think that this is deliberate. Racism, and I think that this is deliberately done to confuse victims of racism when they are assessing the surroundings and the demographic makeup of our cities and of our communities. And I just think that yeah, they're purposely doing this. They're not doing this to the white classification, and I'm just wondering why nobody is bringing that up. I remember when they brought up the idea that there are they tallied the number of hate groups in the United States, and then they came out with a chart that had Black separatist groups at the top with the largest number, and then they had all of these different segmentations of white groups, and they didn't, you know, tabulate them to say they're all white and racist. I think that they're just playing games with the representation of the data here, and that's just a very, very apparent way that they're doing this on official documents. And then also I think that they're making a concerted effort to alienate Black Americans from Black people worldwide. I think that there's just a concerted effort, and I think that this new segmentation of the Black identity in the census, I think that that's just one more front in that effort. And then finally, with the prenatal care story, You know, I think that it was interesting that they mentioned that the effects of the chronic stress that racism puts forward. And I think that really needs to be accounted for scientifically, biologically. I think that more Black people need to be made aware of the hormonal changes that we experience when we deal with racism, so that once it's made apparent that there are physiological problems with having to deal with racism, then we'll be far more serious about dealing with it. And I think that it was very interesting about how they mentioned that just not chastising people for being late, that was, that played significantly in the outcomes of their child's, the first parts of their child's life. So the idea that Black people are constantly worried about not being late, constantly worried about underperforming, constantly under the stress of racism, I think that it needs to be addressed scientifically. I think that there needs to be a focus on mitigating for these effects. And I think that exercises, which previously mentioned, will play a significant part in alleviating a lot of the problems that are associated with dealing with racism on a chronic basis. And I'll go ahead and mute my line from there. Thank you so much.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Greetings, Kamisha M. Africa, longtime listener, guest, investor. Big reason we've been able to be on the air for 9 years. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard? Okay. I know she can go first.
Thank you. Ma'am, did you have commentary?
No, I'm sorry. I thought someone else was speaking. Thank you to the gentleman who yielded the floor. This is the caller in Wisconsin. I actually was listening to the compensatory call-in last Saturday, and I was thinking about HD's question about anger. And so there are a few things that I do to sort of suffuse anger, and I think they might be constructive for other people. So I think the main thing that I try to do is replace the thoughts that I'm having with other thoughts. And I've used three sort of techniques to do that. The first is meditation. And to me, meditation is just focus. So it could take a myriad of forms. You don't have to just be sitting cross-legged, chanting to meditate. But if you focus on a task and focus on a task in the specific steps to complete that task, that can help replace the thoughts in your head. So even with a hobby, so I like to knit, and I use that knitting to, you know, I have to count the stitches and I have to be very correct, and I use that to replace whatever thought of anger that I have, because I mean, that'll just consume you. It's I don't want to use a metaphor, so I was going to say something. But I would think that any sort of exercise that requires what I like to call no thinking, which is, you know, any sort of exercise. I'm driving somewhere and I start thinking about the steps that I need to take there. What are the streets that I need to take to get to the final destination? Any sort of hobby I have where, you know, I'm thinking about the steps that it will take to complete the task, even washing the dishes, for example, thinking about what you'll wash next. First, I'm washing the glasses, then I'm washing the plates, et cetera, et cetera. That helps to sort of replace the thoughts, because I found, and other people have said this to me as well, you can't think two things at once, you know, so you take those thoughts and you replace them with another thought. The second thing that I do is I like to play songs in my head when I'm starting to feel angry, because then I have to focus on lyrics. And I personally prefer like Black Star, Flip Quali, Mos Def. I like to do those lyrics in my head. But, you know, whatever, something that will allow you to stop thinking about what you're angry about and think about something else. The last and final thing that I do, you know, and I advocate this, and I hear Emmy talking, and I know she does this, and Gus, you're doing it, a lot of people are doing this, but really using your skills and talents to erode the system of white supremacy. Because even no matter how small you think it is, it's something more than what's already being done. And I think that this system, it tries to tell us that we don't have skills and talents, that we're not smart enough, that we're not, you know, talented enough, that we don't have the things that we need to erode the system. But they're only telling us that because they know that we do, and they want us to believe that lie. So, and also, talking about the mothers and the high mortality rates or the high pregnancy, I guess the issues with pregnancy that Black mothers have. I've seen similar sort of rhetoric come out in Milwaukee, where they're saying now that 40% of all Black teenagers in Milwaukee have syphilis and HIV. And on one hand, I'm like, wow, that's a serious problem, and we need to address it. But on the other hand, I'm like, wait a minute, why are they saying this? You know, are they trying to encourage people not to procreate? Are they trying to stop people from doing the things that it takes to create another generation? And I was listening to the Dr. Amani Shaked Ani. I hope I'm saying her name correctly. I was listening to that in the archives, and she said something very interesting. She said something like, you know, I have to question everything that I hear in the media, and I think that's what we need to do. We always need to question whatever we hear in the media. I teach my son that, and I think that's very important, because we have to think about the source and what their goal is. Their goal is always to strengthen and maintain this system. So anything that they're telling us has to be looked at with a critical eye. Thank you for letting me share. I'll mute my line.
Indeed. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, I think President Trump, he said Congresswoman Maxine Waters, not very smart. That was this week too, almost in the audio clips. Other folks we have not heard from.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Salam alaikum to the cows. Peace be upon the cows. Listeners, host, and platform. What I wanted to speak about was this week seeing the terrorism that we faced being called hate crimes. And, you know, I truly think that it was an act of domestic terrorism at the hands of a white identity extremist, for lack of better use of better words. And, you know, we're faced with terrorism, but they're calling it hate crimes. And, you know, they're enforcing on the alleged hate crimes or terrorists instead of Black people who are competent about racism, white supremacy, and how it works, and the terrorism that's coming from the system of racism, white supremacy. So I think that was very monumental this week, very big thing that a lot of Black people got to see, a modern day act of what we would consider terrorism if it came from a person who said they were a Muslim or Allahu Akbar or something like that, and they put a bomb or leave a bomb, then we competently understand that a little bit, I think. But when it's the racist white supremacists and Christianity who are the culprits, or Satanism at least, or Freemasonry are the culprits, then It's like we don't understand. But I just want to see black people or victims of racism, white supremacy, start to be more competent about what's going on with us, especially in the area of war, because if you don't participate, then I guess we all know that you didn't participate. You know, if we're not participating in that area and people are just waging war on us and we don't understand how to defend ourselves or take action, then I think that, you know, we should learn about that. And I think that that in itself affects the condition of our women when they give birth. They don't live in a safe, peaceful environment that they should without any terrorism. That's all I want to say.
Appreciate that. Terrorism absolutely affects how you function and the child during birth. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to guests, the hosts, the listeners, and callers. The first thing I wanted to start out with was it was two things that I observed from the news. I was at work for this first one, and I think it may have been that contrast programming thing I think that Dr. Wilson mentioned, where it was a couple of weeks ago where they were talking about the school shooting person, the Nicholas Cruz, I think, and you know, they were pretty much setting a priority on trying to change the gun laws. And, you know, there was mentioning about gun violence. And then after that segment, they went to a segment where there was this black male. He was FaceTiming, I think that's what it's called. And he had the camera on him. And he was going around the neighborhood or a residential area, I guess, trying to get information on maybe a suspected drug dealer or something of that nature. So there's a black male that runs up in the background on the camera, and he comes up to confront him, this other black male recording himself. And apparently this guy gets killed on camera. So, you know, I was thinking about that segment for a couple of weeks, and I wanted to share that. And I'm thinking that was an example of that contrast programming, like showing them, like devaluing a black person's life, and, you know, actually showing the footage of him, of his last moments. And there was another interview, I think it was on, where I think it was the governor, or maybe a former governor, I think his name, John Kasich from Ohio, and he was being interviewed or something like that by the news anchor. And she was talking about Trump, and when he made those comments about the people from other countries, you know, being, he compared them to a toilet. He used a name-calling term. And I think she had asked him, you know, well, is Trump a racist? Trump is a racist. She was trying to get him to say it. So she was asking him at the end of the segment, well, is Trump a racist? And the guy, he says, you know, I don't engage in name calling. So I just found that very, very smooth what he said. So I never really saw anything go down like that or happen that way. And there was, I think, that segment where the suspected racist or the race soldier who put the, who defiled the person's cosmetic products, you know, spitting in them and whatnot. And I guess they weren't able to prove that that was an act of racism. I think that's going to happen more often. And I don't know, maybe they haven't brought up, like, what's the definition of racism? Or, you know, I don't know if the judges or attorneys had a present definition there and they can contest it and, you know, go about how can you define it and, you know, how is it acted right now? Because that term was used, Jamaican Barbie. I don't know if that's like a, some kind of oxymoron or something. And what was interesting was that a Barbie was mentioned in another segment to practice racism. Like, did, you know, did anybody catch that? I guess it was the word nigger was written on a package or something. So I guess in one instance, they'll you know, constitute it as racism. And then in the courtroom, you know, area of law, they'll say, well, hey, this doesn't prove enough to me that this is racism. So, you know, I say that it's not, and, you know, the case is over, and that's pretty much it. And the victim is still terrorized from this, you know, the trauma and the health effects, like what was mentioned before, you know, everything pretty much is caused by the race issue. And that's all I have to say right now, and thanks for allowing me to speak.
Appreciate that. Caller down in Florida. Everything is caused by the system of white supremacy, racism. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Great commentary about contrast programming. That's the way Dr. Frances Cress Welsing labeled it. I think some of the examples that she gave, she would say, like, if you watch a news broadcast in the mornings, you'll see white broadcasters talking seriously about, you know, global affairs and things that are happening. And then they'll show a black person being a buffoon and putting on deodorant and taking his shirt off and, you know, just being a total clown, victim of white supremacy. But contrast programming, this is how you are supposed to see black people. And then you put that up next to racist man, racist woman being serious, suit and tie, running the world. That I thought significant, because I think most of the time when they have, you know, shootings of whites, they do not show their last few moments. But with black, I mean, hey, you know, take your pick from the last, you know, 10, 20 years. I mean, that's constantly being shown and displayed and replicated. And we reading the book right now. They even got it in the fiction. You can't get away from it. Constant images of black death and being comfortable and enjoying and making fun of black people dying, making a sport out of black death. Other folks that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Gus, and all the listeners and callers. This is my first time calling in. Wow. You have such a powerful broadcast tonight, and I was compelled to call. The segment on the census has been a topic of discussion in another group that I'm a participant in. And I think it's interesting that at this time in the United States political climate, they want to now count descendants of slaves. They want to have a clear designation, or so they say, in this article by NPR. Well, one of the groups that I participate in, they believe, and I do too, that it's time. It's time for descendants of slaves to be separated from the other groups. And the reason being is all of these groups have benefited from the services that were set aside for descendants of slaves. Other groups have also made it very clear that when you approach them, and it even said in that segment, I am not African American. They will designate I am from Nigeria, or I'm from some country within the African continent. But when it comes to services, whether it be housing, food, jobs, education, oh, I'm African American then. And so for me, if the census in 2020 will help designate descendants of slaves, and that group, and I consider myself a descendant of slaves, if that group will now be recognized, not for the purposes of showcasing, but to say, look, I understand you come from a country that has colorism or colonialism, but in the United States, descendants of slaves have a unique set of circumstances. We built the richest country in the world, and we have been denied our reparations. And reparations to me means make it right. Make what we've needed in this country as citizens right, whether it be jobs, housing, food, education, protection under the law. And the other designation is we pay taxes. When I heard that segment in there and Maxine Waters wouldn't address that, and then the sister talked about what we need to do about the anger, I had to concentrate on my breathing. I had to just stop and say, breathe, breathe, because she was elected by citizens of the United States to do a job, and she's not doing her job. And it's time for that to be addressed. And the final thing that I wanted to speak on or share was that we have been under attack. We have been at war since we came here. So if no other reason to believe that the bombings, the race soldiers killing us in the streets, excuse me, if that's not an act of war, then people don't know what war is. They don't know what war is. I know I'm under attack every day. Every day I wake up, my eyes pop open. I know I got to do some kind of battle if it's nothing but educating people about racism and white supremacy. I'll mute my line.
Thank you, ma'am. First time caller. Glad you were able to chime in this evening. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Other folks, if you have a hand up and we've not heard from you at all, if you have commentary, go ahead with your commentary now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mhandisi. Mr. Gus, can I say something about that movie that came out, The Black Panther? I think it was a horrible movie, but I know you usually don't do a lot of movie talk.
Oh man, like the compensatory call in, we do actually have the rule that Area 8 and entertainment, sexual intercourse, that those are subjects that people get very excited about and will tend to dominate a conversation, and other areas of activity are also very important. I really am like, I would be very, very pleased if I never heard anything else about Black Panther while the system of white supremacy exists. But I can tolerate a final comment so that nobody else can dial in. I was patient and I even allowed like five more comments than I wanted to hear. So let's hear your commentary if you can keep it concise.
Yes, sir. So the movie is saying what they're doing in real time. So the ICE albinos, the white people, are telling Africans not to work with the Black Americans, and that the Black Americans are highly trained killers returning to Africa to kill all of the kings of Africa and to rule Africa as colonists, similar to white people or ICE albinos. And they're saying, the ICE albinos are telling the Africans that they should work with ICE albinos to prevent Africans from destabilizing their governments and taking over the African people on the continent. They're telling the Africans that they should kill all the Black Americans that have royal blood. They're also saying that white people will not give up white supremacy. And they're saying that if Africans help them reconquer the Black Americans, that they will give Africans a place in the UN. It was a horrible movie. That's all I wanted to say about that. The other thing I wanted to say is to the Africans on the continent, I will continue to say, we need help and we need your assistance. We need the Africans to help us solve this problem. We're going to solve this problem. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Imhan DC. Other folks that we have not heard from, if we have other folks who dialed in, we've not heard from at all, speak up now. Please don't wait till the last 5 minutes. That is not cool at all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I wanted to talk about the census in regards to counting the Black population in separate groups. That is systematically being done. So there's a separation between, you know, all non-white Black people. And also, I do believe that there is an undercount of Black people in this country. And I remember you had somebody on the show, Gus, somebody that a non-white Black man that lived in Brazil, and he talked about, you know, what was going on in Brazil. I remember one of the things that that was discussed was about the number of Black people that were in Brazil. And I know I've never been to Brazil, but I've talked to many people who've been to Brazil, and they talked about how many Black people they saw. But when you look at the numbers, they show like 7% Black people there. And I remember that question was asked of him, and he said something in regards to that in their country, if you have a white parent, then you can actually be counted as white. So, you know, I think they're going to move that strategy over here to the United States so there can be less Black people here. So many non-white people who consider themselves what they call mixed, when they have a Black parent and a white parent, they're probably, you know, going to be given that status, so the numbers of Black folks can be, you know, reduced even lower than the so-called 12% or 14% or whatever percent we have here in this country. And in regards to what you talked about in regards to the solving this problem of racism, I'm going to be truthful. I struggle with that, even though I do believe that this problem can be solved. However, as I learn more about how the system works, and I'm still learning, you know, I learn about how the system of white supremacy has basically kind of taken over my life and has been in control of my life, you know, all this time. And, you know, when you start seeing stuff like this, you know, it does give you a bit of discouragement, you know, but then again, you know, you have to believe that, you know, something has to change. And also too, when I interact with, you know, not just non-white Black people, but just non-white people in particular, you know, I don't know if it's just my circle of people, but, you know, they're even more confused than I am in regards to racism. So, you know, I guess I just have to have hope, you know, and I know that's a, you know, icky word to a lot of people, but I just, and I know that might be a metaphor, but, you know, like I said, as I learn more about racism and how it is, you know, how white supremacy has just taken, you know, has been in control of my life all this time, you know, you get discouraged. So, I do believe that it will be solved. I'm just not sure when, you know, hopefully in my lifetime, but, you know, at least in my children's lifetime, it will be solved. So that's all for now. Meet my line.
Just one thing I did want to say briefly, since the compensatory calling, we are supposed to be mindful of word usage. That I think that's a big part of how we are going to solve this problem, being more precise with our use of words. I think an improvement better than just things have to change, because things do change regularly. The plantation of racism, white supremacy is constantly being refined. It's not just the Toni Morrison great line from her book, The Bluest Eyes. She says things changed, but were not improved. We don't want things to change. We want the problem to be solved. That's what I mean. I think just being more precise about what we are thinking about, asking for, praying for, if it's a chant, a salutation, just trying to be more precise. I think that will get us closer to solving the problem. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Let's get retired firefighter first.
Greetings, everyone. I'll start off with the infant mortality subject. I would say first of all, even with life-saving procedures, non-white black people are not offered the same extent of life-saving procedures as white people are. And I just think the whole idea about infant mortality being higher amongst non-white people and non-white black people specifically, under a system of racism and white supremacy, is logical that black people's infant mortality is going to be greater. Bombings in Texas. No, I agree. They have not been advertised, put on the news more. And I think that's on purpose because of the extension of what that can possibly mean. As far as that concern, they would rather just hear the, for the most part, white children protest on gun control as opposed to that particular incident. Because it does mean that perhaps maybe some of the races who are still more from the standpoint of against refinement, kind of like following procedure of more refined practice. I have a incident that took place in the area where I'm allowed to stay at. There is a lot of traveling salesmen. I'll just call it that, identified as traveling salesmen, that goes from house to house on a weekly basis. And in this case, the product that was being sold was religion. And so most times I don't answer the door, but this particular time it was it appeared to be a white person and a non-white person. Wearing white shirts and ties and dark trousers. So I decided to work on my counter-racist interaction, especially with the person who appeared to be white. The person who spoke the most as far as introducing himself was the person who appeared to be white. I quickly asked him, are you a white person? And he stated very quickly, yes, I am. When I asked the person who appeared to be non-white, and I put it in this way, I said, are you a white person or a non-white person? He first went to inform me on where he's quote unquote from. And he said, Mexico. I said, sir, I didn't ask you where you were from. I asked you, are you a white person or a non-white person? There are white people in Mexico. And finally he really didn't give me a audible answer. And then I asked him, I said, well, on a job application, if you have filled out a job application, what box did you check? And he said other. So I said, well, that would, I think, make you a non-white person. Basically, what I did with the white person, I informed him, I said, whatever, he mentioned that he was a missionary. I said, whatever you are selling in regards to religion, you are in the wrong place with what you're doing. You need to, I would suggest that you go to white people with it. And when you report back to me, that means there's no longer a system of racism or white supremacy. And then I would be more prompt to listen to what you have to say. Good day. Well, no, I didn't say good day. I said goodbye. But anyway, one thing that I've been hearing quite a bit is the lumping of every time the problem, every time a problem of racism comes up or problems come up, non-white people, especially non-white black people, are lumped in with the quote unquote LGB. I can't recall all of the initials. To whereas, I mean, it's almost a part of the different groups, and I noticed that. That is lumped in a lot also with quote unquote feminism. It's all lumped in together as though it seems to be an attempt to dismiss the global system of racist white supremacy and its victims. Down here in South Florida, as I'm sitting here, there is a yearly event that's called Jazz in the Gardens. Some of you may have heard about it. Just, you know, thoughts on it, of the strain and stress that non-white people go through, especially non-white black people go through on a 365, 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis. And I guess black people are finding a means to relax. But I would say, you know, VGQ to that, but at the same time, we do not do a good job of focusing on the problem. And I would emphasize that it is a global problem. The system of racist white supremacy is a global problem. And even if non-white people who quote unquote born from slavery, I still think the problem would still be here if we are given some money, as far as they're concerned, just logically speaking. The problem would still be here. Last but not least, what do I have here? Oh, the lack of belief in the system of racism ending. I suspect that thought is popular amongst the victims because on how consuming the system of racism, white supremacy is. A lot of cases, we're in denial of it, but in our own personal space, I think most of us do recognize it. And kind of like, you know, without, you know, I guess it may be kind of embarrassing to admit it, kind of like think, well, you know, it's impossible to get rid of. I am not of that thought. Maybe at one time when I was a lot younger, it was, but as I gotten older and through constant studying and interacting and even some cases trying to participate into solving the problem, I can see where it can be neutralized and replaced with a better system. I don't place any time on how long or short it would take for that to happen. It can happen. It doesn't have to take as long than what it did to establish it. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Other folks that we have not heard from, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Let's get Roz first.
Peace and love to you, Gus, and to the other callers and listeners. This is a powerful program. I must agree with the previous Black female that stated that. I thought it was really, really great. And I just have a few things I wanted to speak on. The mortality rate for Black females giving birth, I think that that's accurate. Just from study, like Emmy said, and greetings to you too, just studying the system. I would just say go back to medical apartheid. I think it's laid out very eloquently there. If anyone has seen the Ma'afa 21 film, which I've seen it, and even got the DVD, it just elucidates quite a bit. There's an attack on the Black body from in the womb. They call it womb lynching in Ma'afa 21, which I thought there was a Black reverend who coined that term in the video, and I thought it was one of the most accurate terms I'd heard. So I actually adopted it in my conversations about the subject because it's accurate. With all the things that we have gone through, the systematic attacks in all 10 areas of people activity, it just goes without saying that that is the case without question. Now, to tie that into the census, I do believe that they are definitely obfuscating the numbers of Black Americans in this country without question. Just the sheer amount of time that has passed, there's no way that that Black people would still be 13% of the population of the United States after like 50 years. That's just insane. Regardless of how many of us that they are dying in during birth or within the first year after birth, that still doesn't make sense, especially with the steady decline of white people's numbers. And I also believe that the census itself can be both beneficial and detrimental. Detrimental in the sense of creating further separatism between different Black groups in this country, immigrant groups versus Black American groups or descendants of slaves, as enslaved people, I should say, that the Black female elucidated or spoke about earlier. But I also, and I said this on my own radio show, that I believe that there needs to be specific programs in this country of reparation type of programs that specifically cater to the experience of American Africans. I just think that that's imperative for the reasons that the other Black female stated. I said the same thing, that there was a fight fought by, you know, American Africans, in which a lot of other groups, and especially white females, were able to benefit the most from programs that were meant to be a form of reparations, whether it's affirmative action or other programs. So I just think that there needs to be specific programs that are geared towards American Africans that no one else has access to, because they have a unique experience here that no one else has. And that has to be addressed, and it never has been adequately addressed as far as I'm concerned. I think the other thing in which you were discussing, you asked a question about solving the problem of racism. I think the problem could be solved in overnight to like a week. And the main reason was just watching this situation that unfolded after the Parkland shooting in Florida, when white people wanted to get stuff done, those white students, which I don't consider any white child a child. I believe that they function like adults. I don't care how old they are. they know their position in the system, and they play that position well. And when you saw what happened with the shooting, they were able to get schools nationwide, students nationwide, to get on board. They had celebrities tweeting and encouraging them in their practicing of trying to change the gun laws and things of that nature. And that happened overnight. It was in no time flat. We were hearing that there's going to be a nationwide walkout with the 17-minute walkout. And that was done in no time flat because everyone was on the same understanding of what the problem was, and everyone was under the same understanding of what they felt needed to be done to solve the problem. And if they can do that, if we should take a strong look at how they did that and think, if we can get enough of our own Black people to understand the system and want to do something about changing it, the same thing can happen. And the greatest example of that would probably be Dr. King and the bus boycotts. You saw how organized Black people that had the same thoughts and ideas and understanding of the system in that particular area of people activity, they were able to shut things down. And I think that it can be done. It's just that not enough of us understand the system and not enough of us are convinced that something can be done about it. I agree exactly what you said about the headstand, Gus, and I'm glad you were able to do that. So, yeah, I totally agree with you on that. Weirdly enough, there's two things I wanted to talk about. There was an event at my wife's store with the other three Black females, and they now have a famous Black designer who is going to be selling his products out of their store on consignment. And he also has had a pop-up shop there today, and he will tomorrow. So there, and he's of African descent, French-speaking African descent. So there were quite a few American Africans there, because it's in Bed-Stuy, the heart of Bed-Stuy, in that area, even though it's gentrified. There's an enclave of Black people who still are holding on to their property and still practicing Black self-respect as far as just maintaining their control of a certain section of the community by owning the buildings and things of that nature, which my wife is in that area, that store. So there was a mixture of American Africans, Caribbean Africans, and Africans from the continent that were here all in the store today. So there was such a mixture of just ideas and thoughts. And my wife and son met a woman from, I believe it's Mauritius, and she had said something to my son. My wife was in earshot but wasn't able to hear the whole conversation. And she had said that white people are having a crisis in Europe and that they are leaving Europe in droves to go to Africa. And she said from her life experience, she's in her 50s, she's about 53. And she said that the main issue that she sees with people on the continent, black Africans on the continent, she said that they're terrified of white people and that they're passive. And that when what she has seen is when white people do come to Africa, they're allowed to basically do whatever they want. And a lot of times in certain areas, the people are basically afraid. So they don't do anything about it. They just allow them to function with reckless abandon in regards to their mistreatment of Black people. And she said that was her observation as far as that, as far as what she saw. And the designer was actually at some points practicing anti-Blackness due to one of the women in the store who was very attractive. She had locks, and he told her she should straighten her hair. So there was a mixture of different mindsets within the store coming in and out constantly. And these conversations were happening all throughout different areas of the store. And I found it quite profound, the ideas that were being discussed. And it was great to see all of these mixes of Black people from all over the place getting along positively and being able to have discussions. Some of them speaking things of Black self-respect, other ones speaking things of not really loving yourself as much as you should. So I found that interesting. And lastly, there was a workplace racism incident that I experienced on Thursday morning that was quite telling. I was waiting for the train to go to New York City. And as the train was pulling in, there was a Black female who was one of the conductors on the train. So I was waiting for the train, and it came around the time that my normal train would come, but it happened not to be the correct train. So this white man and a few other white people asked if the train was express. So the woman said, yes, the train is express from Metro Park to Newark. So it was quite confusing because the express trains are different the way they run from where we are. They skip a whole slew of stops. but the way she said it, it was confusing. So a white man said to her, is this train express to Newark? She said, express from Metro Park to Newark, which meant that it went local from my stop, which is the second to last stop, and only went express from Metro Park to Newark Penn Station, and then from Newark Penn Station to New York Penn Station. So everybody got on the train. A lot of people got on the train, and somebody clarified it with her after she was asked about four times, and she said, no, it's local until Metro Park. She finally clarified. So a bunch of us, including myself, rushed off the train and was waiting, and this white man verbally assaulted her and terrorized her. And he said, why can't you do your job? I asked you a simple question and you couldn't answer a simple question. What's wrong with you? You're acting stupid. And she said, well, talk to your wife that way. Don't talk to me that way. And she just, that was her response to him. So he said, I can't believe you would do something so stupid. And he kept going and going and going. And then finally she kept repeating, talk to your wife that way. He said, I don't need to talk to my wife that way because she wouldn't do something so stupid. And after she basically kept repeating herself, the train finally pulled off and he was talking to other white people in the area. And he said, I can't believe how stupid she is. And you know, you could tell when white people are within a split second from saying something racist. You know that he just wanted to call her all kinds of niggers and B words and all kinds of stuff. But he was trying to hold his peace because there were a lot of us standing in the area. And I noticed that the older black woman who was laughing at what he was saying and agreeing with him. And I was just like, wow, this is crazy to see this woman practice anti-blackness in front of me right here. So I didn't take it any way. I just looked at it like, hey, she's a victim. She made an error. Would I have been annoyed if I sat on the train? Yes, but I wouldn't have. My reaction was not that. And, you know, to see a couple, especially this older black woman, agree with him and then make a comment about it was just disconcerting for me. And it made me just that much more happy that I'm less confused and that I've really worked on my anti-blackness in a way in which what happened with her did not affect me. Whereas when I was more confused, I probably would have been saying things about her, too. So that's all I wanted to say. I hope I didn't talk too long. Thank you so much, Gus. And I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you.
Go ahead, female caller.
Appreciate that.
I'm actually still thinking about what I was going to say, so if it's okay, he can go.
Right on. Greetings to Gus and the other callers. I'm a first time, this is my first time calling in to speak. I listen pretty much weekly and just want to commend the job that you do, Gus, because I know it takes a lot of courage as well as dedication to continue this program. On the subject of the census, I'm convinced at this point, and I'm still learning, of course, but for the time that I have invested into studying racism, what it is and how it works, which is only a few years, maybe 7 years tops now. But with the time that I've invested in terms of researching history, understanding, you know, what has happened just in this country alone, I have no confidence in anything that the dominant white society is doing, whether it be government on the governmental level, whether it be in terms of think tanks and institutions and universities and whatnot. Everything that they, just like Mr. Neely Fuller says, these nine areas of activity, these people have designed a system that has us so locked in, and it either has us divided, confused, definitely divided and confused. And so many of us, we just continue to believe in the best of the potential of humanity. And so we keep giving, you know, white people chance after chance after chance, hoping that one day they will do right by us. And I think, like Gus says in his definition of racism, which I've also adopted as my definition, these people are dedicated to subjugating and dominating, and even if need be, eliminating people that they consider not white. And so I think that this census change is potentially another strategic move that white people have decided to take in another step forward in practicing racism. And I just don't have any confidence in it. Just like Ken Steele, I've never participated in a census because I just don't trust I don't trust them. I feel like they have so much surveillance on us already. They listen in on our phone calls, record our phone calls. They do so much that we are, and those are the things that we know about. And so if they want to know where we are, they want to know where I am, it's on them to figure it out. As far as solving this problem, I hate to be one who is contrary tonight, and I've had a very discouraging day as well. So part of the reason why I called in is because I just needed to really connect with like-minded individuals who are striving to counter this racist system that we live in. But I'm just of the opinion that so many of us are divided and confused. You have victims who will fight other victims to help maintain the system of white supremacy. For some reason, it's like it's almost as if we don't really understand. Well, I don't think it's almost, we don't really understand as a whole who we are and where we are. And so because of that, we have divided interests. Some of us think that in the system of white supremacy, we can be comfortable and we don't necessarily have to actively work to end the system and replace it with a system of justice. And those victims will fight against what they would see as more radical victims who want to end this system. And I try to be patient with myself as well as other victims, but I am not encouraged that we can end this system. I think that the system will end, but I don't know that we will still be here when it does end, because we are so confused, yes, sir, and divided. And the system will probably end because it will ultimately just collapse in on itself. And hopefully we'll still be here to benefit from the new system that's put in place. Thank you, sir.
Appreciate that. First time callers, grand to hear from both of you all tonight so far. Other folks that we missed completely, HV, are you prepared, or did you need more time to collect your thoughts?
I hope I am. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to everyone on the line. I want to say to the woman in Wisconsin, the software developer, thank you for your advice about just managing anger at just racist. I'm going to take your advice. I'm hearing an echo. Is everyone else hearing it?
I hear it as well.
Let me see.
Might just be someone on speakerphone.
Okay. I wanted to say about the infant mortality rate. I think that it's actually not true. It's a lot of conflicting things about it. First, we've been suffering from racism for the longest. Why is this just coming up now? Also, they have the way that they come up with these numbers is based on a certain amount of deaths per 1,000 live births. I would say that that's manipulative and just a distortion of data, that the ones that die have nothing to do with the ones that are born. Also, I looked at the raw numbers, and it's whites, then black people, then Mexicans, and then, you know, other people. And the whites, they have like 7,000 that are dying each year, and we have like 5,000, and then I think Mexicans have like 1,000, and that's the actual rate. A certain amount per the ones that are being born is not the rate. The rate is X amount of deaths per year, and we are second in line. And also, they tried to, when using the rate, they tried to say it was like 11 per 1,000 births. Number one, that's not a lot. If 1,000 are being born and only 11 are dying, but even in going with that, if we have 600,000 that are born, it just seems like 11 per thousand is not even adding up. Another thing that I wanted to say is we had a conversation about white ignorance. And I brought up the fact that, you know, saying that whites are ignorant about racism is like saying LeBron James is ignorant about basketball. And someone said that, you know, he's not an expert because he doesn't make as much money as Donald Sterling, and that a mechanic isn't an expert because they don't make as much as Henry Ford. Well, Henry Ford and Donald Sterling could very well be experts, but they could also just be white in a system of white supremacy. So making more money doesn't necessarily mean that. We've seen a lot of examples where, you know, Serena Williams keeps dominating this white woman who keeps making way more money than her. People on jobs, they get these white people, they get jobs, supervisory positions, and non-white people have to train them. They have no idea what they're doing. So just because you have more money doesn't necessarily mean you are an expert. And I'm not saying that Donald Sterling and Henry Ford are not experts, but they may not be. But even with that said, at worst, you have two experts. LeBron has proven that he's an expert at basketball. A mechanic has proven that they are an expert at knowing what a car is and how it works just by their track record. And I think that's all I had. And I'll move on. Thanks, Gus.
Yes, ma'am. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, feel free. Had interrogation of a metaphor on the compensatory call-in. I think that's, wow, a impromptu interrogation of a metaphor from a previous broadcast. Wow. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary. Did we get everybody? Anybody that has a hand up that we've not heard from at all? Grand. I will assume that we got everybody and should not have anybody in the last minute or so saying, oh, you missed me and I didn't get an opportunity to speak. Did anybody have any additional comments they wanted to make sure that they share before we depart? We have about 10 minutes, a little less than 10 minutes.
Gus, can I quickly say, I left this out, that I put on your Facebook page the numbers about the infant mortality rates, and I put the page number as well for the PDF for you and anyone else who wants to see it, and I'll mute my line.
Oh, that was one thing I wanted to say. I think in the clip they were talking about maternal mortality rates. I think that's not the same as infant mortality rates. They were talking about mothers dying during the birth process or shortly after. And I think infant mortality rates is talking about actual infants that are dying. That's two different things, unless I misheard.
Actually, I think you're absolutely right. Thank you for that. I'll look that up, too. Thanks, Gus.
Mm-hmm. Coincidentally, that happened before. The person, or one of the first people that I spoke with who raised the issue that they didn't think that information was accurate, they began talking about infant mortality rates, and we had to have that distinction made again. Anybody else?
Can I say something about that, Gus?
Yes, sir.
I was shocked at working at the hospital when I would get there at night, and they would have a certain room where the nighttime security guards would let the people in to put the dead, people. How many of them? They had little stretchers, which meant it was a baby or a toddler, something small, waiting to go into the freezer. So I just thought that was, I was shocked at me. I mean, it was like almost nightly. It was like, wow, you know, a lot of babies. And I suspect that most of them were black because that's who lived in that area. And also, I just wanted to say, as far as last week, I did make that statement. And I didn't mean it like they make more money. I mean it like they make the decisions regarding the game, regarding the car. I mean, if Henry Ford can't fix a car, he could just have it made in the way he can. He has the power. LeBron has no power. He's just a player. He's an expert at playing the game, passing, dribbling, whatever. But he has no power within that system. The power that he can have, he's not using it. And the people who make the decisions, the white people, the people who own the teams, with the exception of Michael Jordan, the only black one, those are the people with the actual power to make the decisions. I mean, tomorrow they could make LeBron a B-list player. You know, not to use the metaphor, but they could make him, they could put a whole 5-6 other guys on every commercial and give them the sneaker contracts. They have the power to do that. They could make you make him disappear if they want to. Also, I just wanted to hint on well, I'll let someone else go. Go ahead. Thank you. Oh, yeah, yeah. On the train, Vaz made up some made some great points about the train, and I've experienced me catching the train in rush hour again, experienced some racism on the S train the other day. This was, I guess it was a black woman. When I got on the train, this is just a train that's 3 minutes, goes from Times Square to Grand Central, so you can get from the west to the east side. This black lady was yelling at this white man, and she was calling him all types of cracker. And, you know, she was trying to move through this crowded train, and he wasn't going to let her go through. So finally, you know, after that, she goes, "I hate you white people," and then she comes right into me. And she bumps into me, and, you know, she says something smart to me, but I just ignore her. But she just went on the rant for the whole 3 minutes of that ride. And the other day, I'm standing on the train, and I'm holding on to the pole, and there are signs all over the train that says, "Don't lean on the pole." But, you know, people, obviously, they do it. And this white woman, you know, she sees I'm there, and she looks at me like, "Oh, he's just black," and she leans on the pole, and she her hair is on my hand. And I was just like, ew, you know, her fur, I should say, was on my hand. She had blonde fur. And I was like, "Excuse me, you know, can you please get off of my hand? You know, you got your hair on my hand." So she flicked her hair back, like, to be in my face, but I'm way taller than her. It just hit my chest. But she, you know, reluctantly did it. But, you know, it's a lot of racism on the trains. I meet my line. Thank you.
We've had whole programs about that, where a white woman tossing her hair, and 20 minutes later, the enforcement officials were called, glass had been shattered, Negroes were being arrested. Like, that is one you might want to turn and run the other way. Go back and look in the archives. Whites can ruin your life in about 5 minutes. Ma'am, we heard you.
Hello. Oh, thank you so much for taking my call again. Two things. One, it's important, but it's not, it's an example, I should say. The FBI guy got fired before gaining his pension, and I don't really care about him, blah, blah, blah. But I read online that automatically some other person has offered him a job so he can get his pension. You know, I don't think if that was a black person, they would be trying to help him get his pension. They'd be like, "Oh, well, Negro, bye-bye." And second, I think this is important. If you go online and look at the census designations of race, they give you some examples. And then they have a question that says, "What is race?" They don't even know what it is. They go, "Well, we go with the social," basically. Let me found it. Read it. Where did it go? Hold on. More formally, it says, "The racial categories included in the census questionnaire generally reflect a social definition of race recognized in this country and not an attempt to define race biologically, anthropologically, or genetically." So they don't know what race is themselves, but they have these designations. And then I know a lot of times we talk about Hispanic people, so you can take this to them. If they, "Well, I'm Hispanic," according to the census, who doesn't know what race is, but they do know that people who identify, this is a quote from the page, "people who identify their origin as Hispanic, Latino, or Spanish may be of any race." So you can't continue to ask them, "Well, what race are you?" According to the government here, and you can take them to the link or whatever if you want to, you can be of any race. So you can't continue to press the question. And I think that will affect a lot of things, because if you sue based on race, you can say, "Well, the government doesn't know what race is, so there's no race. If they can't define race, there's no racism, there's no suit, there's no hate crime against black people," so on and so forth. Thank you.
Was there another female caller who spoke up?
Yeah, I was there. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I will try to be very brief. Thank you. I've been listening, and I completely resonate and understand the other callers, all of them, who shared that perhaps maybe they're not 100% sure, or maybe they're wavering in whether or not we can solve this problem. And I just want to reiterate some of the things that I hold on to in those moments. One, anything that's been created by people can be it can be destroyed, dismantled, taken apart, replaced by people. We're only in a very short snapshot of time. This has only been a couple of hundred years, but we've been here for arguably hundreds of thousands of years. So this is a very small amount of time. Another thing that I think is important is, you know, to bear in mind that that thought that it cannot, even the feeling, the sentiment or whatever, I am always going to be stressing what it's doing to the body. So like you can develop a pathway where that becomes the natural way that you think about things, the natural way that you respond to things. And that has to be programming by racist white supremacists. And the final thing is, I don't know if we really, not the final, but we really have a choice. War's always been waged against us as far as, you know, for as long as we know, and all that we're talking about, replacing it with a system of justice or justice and all of that. But, you know, bearing in mind the times, just being cognizant of the times. And so that is making us feel maybe this can't happen because it's bad. Every time we get on the compensatory call, it's just the kids are being racist. People are dying everywhere, and it's just really depressing all the time. But we come here hopefully with the intention to get information, to go out there and be counter-racist scientists and soldiers and do our job. And it's not about being radical or anything. It's when you change your vibration and you step into an environment, that's automatically going to change the vibration of the environment no matter what. It's like a law, you know, and that is the revolution. So as you just continue to do your work, and you show up in places, you change those spaces. And somewhere at some time, other people will jump on board and figure it out, and we'll just all exude maximum Black self-respect until the point where white people have to make up their mind. Either they're going to kill us all, or they're going to support making justice. And that's what Mr. Fuller talks about all the time. And like, that's the end. I think he gave it more thought than I have anybody else that I know has. So like, that's it. There's two choices. White people are going to kill us all, which they're getting, you know, it seems as though they're getting ready, or they're going to choose to do justice. But our job is to push them to that point so we can stop living in this pitiful state. So thank you all.
That will wrap us for this year compensatory call in. We will be back multiple times in the coming week. You can check the Black Talk Radio Network page, the Facebook page. All of the upcoming episodes should be posted. If you have problems, questions, gripes, guest suggestions, untiljustice@gmail.com. The email again, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged to all the folks who participated. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Hope you got some constructive information. And again, I contend very, very important that the problem of racism, white supremacy can be solved. Very, very important. And maybe that needs to be explicitly articulated on a regular basis around other non-white people as a point of emphasis, because I contend that most non-white people, as a direct result of being terrorized white supremacy, most non-white people do not think this problem can be solved. That's it. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Let's preserve our brain computers. We need healthy, non-white Black brains thinking about this problem, concepts, new ideas that can be applied to achieve a permanent solution to the greatest problem in the known universe: racist man, racist woman, racist child. Certainly, if you're going to be in a vehicle, buckle up every single time, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.